David Attenborough, The Early Years. Quest Under Capricorn. Written and read by David Attenborough.
Quest Under Capricorn starts in the far northern tropical part of Australia that today is known as Kakadu. Thousands of people go there every year to visit the national park, to delight in its wildlife and to see the rock paintings that are some of the most spectacular in the whole range of Aboriginal art. Back in 1963, however, when this book was written, this fascinating part of the world was little known to outsiders. There were no luxurious hotels, as there are today, and during the whole of the time that we were there, we met less than half a dozen visitors. The most spectacular of its rock paintings had not yet been described, and no photographs of them had been published. Darwin, today a flourishing city, was then still an outback town, uncertain of its future. The wildlife, too, was somewhat different. The swamps and plains were overrun by great herds of water buffalo. They were alien animals, introduced during the 19th century from Asia, and they so dominated the native Australian fauna that, very properly, they have now been eliminated. Perhaps I should add that the equipment we used for filming and recording back in 1963 has also changed beyond recognition. Nonetheless, in spite of all this, I thought it better to leave the text of this book just as I wrote it. One fundamental thing, however, has not changed at all, and that is the splendour and beauty of this northern part of Australia and the character of the remarkable people who live there. And that is what this book attempts to capture. The statistics are daunting. The Northern Territory of Australia extends for 1,000 miles from north to south and for nearly 600 miles from east to west, an area of over 500,000 square miles. In this immense rectangular segment of a continent live a mere 20,000 white Australians and 16,000 Aborigines. It's as though the British Isles were increased in size 6 times and populated only by the inhabitants of one small town, say Dover or Pontypool. As though the Mayor of Maidenhead were responsible for an area extending from his town hall to Berlin in one direction and Tangier in the other, and its townspeople were scattered in a dozen or so small settlements in between. Or, to put it another way, the density of population is the same as if the people of Ashby de la Zouche or Dartmouth were spread out to inhabit the whole of Britain from Land's End to John o' Groats. The Tropic of Capricorn runs across the territory close to its southern boundary. Its northern coast is closer to the equator than is Fiji or Jamaica, Aden or Madras. Here in the north, the country is clothed by jungles that during the monsoon are dripping wet and, over great areas, waterlogged and impassable. Down in the southwest begins one of the most ferociously arid deserts in the world, and one that is still not completely explored. The administrative capital of this huge land is Darwin. No one else on the aeroplane taking us to Australia was going to stay in Darwin. The place for them was just an irritating interruption in the middle of the arbitrary period which the airline had labelled as a time in which to sleep. When we all stumbled out, it was, in Darwin's terms, 4 o'clock in the morning, and in our terms it was no identifiable time at all, since wristwatches had been swivelling throughout the preceding 36 hours. Bleary-eyed, we submitted to the strange catechism of the customs, which at this time in the deserted airport seemed even more nonsensical than normal. Had we any insects with us in any stage of development? Why were we coming to Australia? Were we importing any firearms or horse rugs? Had we a list of the numbers of all the lenses in our cameras? Most of our fellow passengers, having filled in the forms, moved on to the part of the airport known internationally and hideously as the Transit Lounge. For them, Darwin was merely the back door to a continent whose great cities were still 2,000 miles distant. For us, it was the biggest town we were to see in the whole of our time that we were to spend in Australia. On this trip, at least. With me once more was Charles Lagus. We had been together in Darwin 5 years earlier, on our way to film Birds of Paradise in New Guinea. This time, our purpose was rather different. Although we hoped we should be filming birds and many other animals in the territory, our objective was a wider one. We wanted to bring back a series of films that would give a rounded picture of the territory, its people, its landscape, as well as its animals. For the first time on a journey like this, we had an additional companion. Bob Saunders had come with us as sound recordist. This was his first journey outside Europe. He looked round at the depressing, empty airport. "Right," he said, with an enthusiasm that seemed almost indecent at this low ebb in our affairs. "How do we start?" Darwin, perched on the northern rim of Australia, is a lonely town. It's proffered many excuses for its existence since it was named in 1836, a port for pearlers, a clearinghouse for bullion during the gold rushes of the 80s and 90s, a terminal for oil tankers, a link between the end of the Overland Telegraph that reached here in 1872, and the submarine cables that took messages on to London. But none has been convincing enough to sustain a town of any size. Its population has come from all over the world. Chinese families, whose forebears came here to work the gold mines, now ran several of the stores. Newly immigrated Italians and Chinese had travelled up from Sydney to start restaurants and serve schnitzels and ravioli, which were revelations to bushmen brought up on damper and wallaby stew. In the post office you met Cockneys and New Zealanders, a man from Birmingham and another from Brisbane. Only a minority seem involved in the ferocious wilderness that began at the end of the main street. You may occasionally hear a man in a pub talking about gold strikes or a lonely uranium mine. A few Aborigines in vividly coloured sweatshirts lounge outside the cinemas, sucking soft drinks through straws. And occasionally a tall cattleman in a cowboy hat and spurs strides down the street among the dapper bank clerks. We met the most flamboyant of these pioneers of the outback in the bar of Darwin's smartest hotel. He was a florid-faced man, dressed in an extravagant bushwhacker manner, with a red handkerchief knotted at the neck of his checked shirt, tight threadbare breeches, and riding boots. Doug Muir, the owner of the local air charter firm, whom we already knew, introduced the three of us. "This," he said, "is Alan Stewart, and if you blokes are wanting to see some wildlife in the bush, this is the chap to set you right." We shook hands, feeling very hot and unhealthily pallid in comparison to our two deeply suntanned companions. I explained that we hoped, among other things, to film animals. "Oh, you'll be set like a jelly down at my place," said Alan. "Ducks, geese, roos, barramundi fish the length of your arm, crocs, everything you want." He drained his glass of beer and smacked his lips. "That one went down without touching the sides," he remarked appreciatively. Doug took the hint. "It's my shout," he said. "You blokes can ease in another charge, I reckon." And he gathered up the empty glasses and went over to the bar. "Mind you," continued Alan, "you'd have to watch out for the buffalo when you're taking your snaps. They can be a bit cranky. You ask Doug about his dad." Doug returned with 5 more beers. "Yeah," he said, "the old bloke was just fossicking around in the scrub, and this big bull buffalo shot out from nowhere, wanged him down, and started giving him a going over. He's tough, the old man, and he caught hold of the buff's horns and started twisting its neck. Eventually the buff reckoned it had had enough and left. But the old man was in a poor way. 4 broken ribs and some nasty bruises here and there. Had to bring him into hospital to get him fixed up. That was 3 weeks ago, and he only came out today." "These buffalo sound rather bad-tempered," I said, in what I hoped sounded a nonchalant tone. "What does one do to avoid trouble?"
"Shoot 'em," said Alan, draining his glass. "I suppose you blokes carry guns?"
"Well, no," I admitted, feeling more than ever the effete Englishman. "As a matter of fact, I doubt if I'd be able to hit a charging buffalo, even if I'd got one."
"Then don't carry one," said Alan severely. "There are too many blokes going around with guns who couldn't hit a bull's backside with a basket full of wheat at 2 yards.
But what do we do if a buffalo turns nasty then?" persisted Bob.
"Shin up a tree," Doug said. "Quick time." There was a girl who was knocked over by a buff, and as it knelt on her, she just stroked its nose and said, "There, there." She got away with no more than bruises. "You might try that," said Alan helpfully.
"Of course, if you're in a car, that's not so bad," said Doug. "One chap last year met a buff head-on in the road. He drove at a fair lick for 2 miles in reverse before the buff slowed down and decided that it wasn't interested."
"Still, I suppose they're pretty scarce, these buffaloes," said Charles, endeavouring to look on the bright side.
"Scarce?" said Alan, in an indignant tone. "There's mobs of 'em, a couple hundred strong round my place. I told you, it's the best country for wildlife in the whole of the territory."
These buffalo were not the shaggy, humpbacked creatures that once swarmed on the plains of North America, but the very different cow-like beasts of Asia, the water buffalo. A big bull may weigh up to 3/4 of a ton, and be armed with horns curving back from his brow over his shoulders that measure 10 feet from tip to tip. In their native country, they behave with misleading docility. Uncomplainingly, they drag enormous carts and submit to the ferocious beatings of their drivers. They wallow in canals and allow small boys to clamber over them and scrub their hides. Yet even there they have their moments of ferocity, and the unfamiliar smell of a European can be sufficient to irritate them so much that they will suddenly run amok, overturning their carts and charging anyone who comes near them. Over a century ago, they were imported into Australia from Timor to provide the newly founded military settlements at Raffles Bay and Port Essington on the north coast with meat and milk and to serve as draft animals. But in 1849, the garrisons were abandoned and the buffalo turned loose. The country suited them, and since then they have flourished. For the most part, they're now left to wander across the plains unharmed, except around places such as Norlanji, Alan's camp. Originally, Norlanji was a timber concession, but when the trees had been worked out, Alan took over the lease, built some huts as additional accommodation, and called the place a safari camp. The buffalo became transformed into big game and were listed with crocodiles, kangaroos and wildfowl as an attraction for sportsmen from the cities of the south who were anxious to savour the inexplicable thrill of slaughter. However, it seemed that Alan's campaign to flood the territory with big game hunters was not flourishing. Norlanji was almost deserted. If we went there, we should have huts to live in, the service of a bush radio and a private airstrip. It seemed a good place to use as a base. There were obviously plenty of buffalo there, and doubtless many of the other creatures that we were hoping to film. We decided to accept Alan's invitation. He himself was flying back that afternoon. We would follow by road with all our gear as soon as we could hire ourselves a Land Rover. There was only one way out of Darwin by land, the Stuart Highway. The road was affectionately known as the Bitumen, a name which in itself gave an indication of its unique character, for apart from a branch leading eastwards into Queensland, it was the only surfaced road in the entire territory, and being so, the only one negotiable during the rainy season. The Bitumen was built between 1940 and 1943 to bring military supplies up to Darwin when the Japanese invasion of New Guinea put the town into the front line. 20 yards wide and nearly 1,000 miles long, it ran almost due south through eucalyptus scrub and across rocky desert to Alice Springs. There it was succeeded by a stony potholed track that continued for another 1,000 miles to Adelaide. We drove for over 100 miles without passing any settlement of more than half a dozen houses, and at last reached Pine Creek. Even here there were barely more than a dozen buildings. The biggest was splendidly labelled Residential Hotel in illuminated lettering. We drew up thankfully and went in. It was Saturday night and the bar was full of men in their shirt sleeves bawling in one another's ears. The barman directed us through a glass door etched with the word foyer, and we found ourselves in a wasteland of chromium tubular steel tables adorned in this country of wattle, orchids and bougainvillea with white plastic tulips. A statuesque lady emerged from the kitchen beyond to welcome us. She produced a meal and sat down with us to talk. As we ate, the shouts of the men in the bar grew louder.
"Do you keep a chucker out here?" I asked conversationally.
"Do it myself," said our hostess, folding her muscular arms. "My oath I do."
I was fully prepared to believe it. "Things are quiet these days, though," she continued. "This isn't the back of beyond any more, though people down south still seem to think we're a rough mob here. Do you know," she added, in an outraged tone, "when my daughter got married here a few months ago, some writer from a newspaper rang out from Sydney and asked how many of the wedding guests arrived on camels."
We shook our heads sympathetically. From the bar beyond came a sustained crash of breaking glass, followed by angry shouts.
"Excuse me," she said meaningfully, and strode out.
The next morning we set out early to cover the remaining 80 miles to Nalanji. The country was much the same as that we had seen on our way to Pine Creek, but now we had turned off the bitumen and the unsurfaced road soon dwindled to a winding track. On the bitumen we had at least seen other cars occasionally. There had been road signs, and although it was a lonely road, there was plenty of evidence of the hand of man. Here, apart from the track itself, the country was unmarked. There were no buildings, no telegraph poles, nothing. The land seemed completely empty. Once, when we stopped to let the engine cool, we heard, to our astonishment, the sound of hooves. A tall horseman emerged from the scrub. He was bare-chested and barefooted. A can of beer hung from his saddle. "If you see a couple of blokes with a mob of cattle, tell them that the good parlour jeep is jiggered," he said. And then, without waiting for a reply to this enigmatic request, he pulled round his horse's head and trotted away. He was the only human being we saw between Pine Creek and Nalanji. We reached Alan's camp in time for lunch. As we sat in the mess hut quenching our thirst, the only other guest staying there appeared at the door. He had just emerged from a shower and was clad only in his underpants and a long shapeless vest that barely covered his enormous slack stomach. He was a butcher, who had come up from Melbourne for a few days' sport. The sun had scorched an angry scarlet triangle at his neck. His forearms were peeling. He was not my conception of an intrepid white hunter.
"G'day," we said, slipping into the vernacular. "You right?"
"Ball of muscle," he replied with gusto, giving the side of his chest such a clout with his fist that the whole of his body rippled like a blancmange. "If I felt any better, I couldn't stand it." We discovered the cause of his exuberance was that only a few hours before he had put a bullet through the brain of a large bull buffalo as it stood looking at him in the scrub.
"Yeah," he said enthusiastically and with surprising perception. "It's been a great trip, a real busman's holiday." And he laughed.
Although the butcher, on the strength of having spent 4 days driving through the bush with an Aboriginal guide beside him to point out the buffalo, was prepared and indeed anxious to tell us all about the habits of these beasts, where we could find them, how close we could approach them, we felt that we could get more reliable information from an old buffalo hunter named Yorkie Billy. Yorkie lived a mile away from Nalanji with his wife, 5 children, and a string of horses. His home was simply a large patched tarpaulin stretched over poles. From its guy ropes hung strips of meat drying in the sun. In front of it smouldered a small log fire. Yorkie was in his 70s. His hair was grey and his legs bowed by a lifetime spent in the saddle. His skin was as dark as an Aboriginal's, but his features were European. Few people could know the country and its animals better than he, for he was born here.
"My father came out here to prospect for gold," he said. "They called him Yorkie Mick, because he came from Yorkshire."
"Yorkshire?" I said, surprised.
"Yeah, it's part of the British Empire," he explained patiently. "A territory north of London somewhere. My old man used to grow spuds and onions up there. But I don't reckon it can be much of a place, covered in snow most of the time. My father reckoned this is much better country."
He stroked his walrus moustache. "Didn't find his gold, though."
Like his father, Yorkie had married an Aboriginal. She was a young girl with the thinnest legs I've ever seen. While we talked, she stayed shyly with the children in the tent.
"'She's my second wife,' Yorkie said. "'I found my first one just wandering about in the bush. "'She's dead now. "'This one was given to me by tribal promise. "'Her parents promised her to me before she was born. "'That's a promise you don't break. "'Course, it's a bit of a toss-up. "'Might not have been a girl, for one thing. "'Then I had to wait a bit of time before I could marry her. "'But she's a good wife to me.' He had camped by an Orlantia with his horses in order to hire them out to any of the big game hunters who might want them. Most, however, preferred to do their shooting from a jeep, and Yorkie was on hard times. The old days had been better when he worked as a buffalo shooter on the plains. "'Used to get £20 for the hide of a big bull, but there's no price for him now,' he said. "'So I make a few pounds where I can. Get a quid a tail for dingo.' Croc skins still fetch a fair price when you can get 'em, and I still keep an eye open for the gold my old man never found. "'Are these buffalo really dangerous?' I asked. "'Oh, my word, they are. You get an old bull that's had a bullet in his backside some time, and he'll come for you all right. And then there are others that are just naturally a bit frisky. They'll come for you too. I've often had to jump up a tree in a hurry. Well, now, how do we avoid trouble?' "'Don't go nearer them than 50 yards. "'You can tell the bad uns because they got a cranky expression on their faces.' "'I explained that we were not sufficiently familiar with buffalo's expressions "'to distinguish a sour look from a friendly one, "'especially at a distance of 50 yards. "'Well, if he comes for you and you haven't got a gun, "'and there's no tree to shin up,' Yorkie said, "'there's only one thing to do. "'Wait till he gets within a few yards of you "'and then fall flat on the ground.' He'll just jump over you and gallop on. Filming birds around Nalanji was, from a technical point of view, relatively easy. By building hides, by cruising slowly across the flats in the car with the cameras at the ready on our knees, by stalking slowly and quietly through the pandanus thickets, we soon had shots of pygmy geese, 3 species of ibis, 4 different kinds of duck, 4 species of egrets, herons, darters, stilts, eagles, and many other birds, as well as long sequences of the magpie geese. Recording them also posed few problems, and Bob steadily accumulated on tape the voices of every species we filmed. Often it was easier for him to work alone, away from the noise of the camera. As long as there was a group of the same kind of bird, both on the film and the recording, the sound and picture would match one another, and there would be no difficulty later in putting the two together. But if we were filming a single creature, then, in order to capture its individual calls and the precise rustles made by its every movement, filming and recording would have to be done simultaneously. This was a much more difficult technical problem. Charles would have to muffle the noise of the camera by shrouding it with a padded canvas cover called a soft blimp. This was so bulky and cumbersome that it made the use of a tripod essential and entangled the lenses in so many layers of foam, rubber and padding that adjusting the focus and aperture became a major problem. Bob's job would be equally complicated. He would have to set up his microphone in such a position that it couldn't be seen by the camera, and had not only to run a cable between it and the recorder, but also to lay another, linking the recorder with the camera, so that the tape received a pulse from the camera's motor, which would enable us later to synchronise exactly the sound and the picture. All this would have to be done before the animal concerned took fright and disappeared. The first time we tried this technique came one evening after we had spent several hours trying to film the pelicans without success. While Bob and Charles were dejectedly dismantling the equipment and stowing it away in boxes, I strolled into a nearby spinney of gum trees. I'd gone about 200 yards when suddenly I became aware that what I'd taken from a distance to be a log was in fact a surprisingly large lizard. It was a goanna, a creature we were very anxious to film. He lay broadside on to me, his head held erect, as motionless as a statue. He was about 4 feet long, dull grey with tinges of yellow on his throat, and he stared at me with an unflinching, piercing gaze, like a sergeant major, infuriated into speechlessness. I backed away quietly. After I'd retreated several yards,
I quickened my pace, and then I turned and ran. I arrived back at the car just as Bob and Charles were snapping the last clasps on the equipment boxes. "Goanna!" I yelled. "Sink shooting! Quick!" Then I dashed back to the lizard. He hadn't moved. I leaned against a tree, panting, and waited for Charles and Bob to arrive. The goanna and I stared at one another for what seemed like hours before Charles eventually appeared, staggering under the load of the reassembled tripod camera and blimp. Leaving him to watch over the lizard, I ran back to Bob to see if I could help him. He was sitting in the back of the car, carefully sorting through a box of microphone leads. "Funny," he murmured ruminatively. "I'm almost sure I had a sync lead somewhere." I waited, gritting my teeth with impatience, while Bob, with maddening slowness, assembled his gear. There was nothing I could do, so I ran back yet again to rejoin Charles. The goanna still lay in exactly the same position as I'd first seen him. At last Bob arrived. "Well," he said brightly, "got it sorted out in the end." He set up the microphone, carefully laid out the leads, and linked the recorder to the camera. "Sound ready," he announced. With that, the lizard moved for the first time since we had appeared. It ran. With astonishing speed, it tore through a patch of fallen leaves and disappeared down a hole in a tangle of roots at the bottom of a tree. There was no possibility of digging it out. We walked back to the car in silence. None of us said anything as we packed away the gear once more, and we were back in Nalanji before any of us trusted himself to speak. The creature we had failed to film was, in scientific parlance, a ghoul's monitor. There are species of monitor to be found throughout the tropics. Australia has 12, including the smallest of all, a charming miniature a mere 8 or 10 inches long, which lives in the west of the continent. Gould's monitor is by no means the largest. Two other kinds, the Prenti and the Lace monitor, which are found in the central deserts, grow to over 6 feet long. In Indonesia, 1,000 miles away to the west, lives the biggest monitor of all, the Komodo dragon. It attains a length of 10 feet and qualifies as the largest lizard in the world today. But Australia once possessed a creature which exceeded even that, for fossil remains have been found of a monitor called Magellania, which grew to the astounding length of 20 feet. The name goanna, which is applied to all Australian monitors, is a little misleading. It's a corruption of the word iguana, which, properly speaking, should be applied only to the handsome lizards of South America that have scaly crests running down their spines. Monitors are quite different. Of all lizards, they're the ones most closely related to snakes. They have long, deeply forked tongues, which they flick out continually, just as a snake does. Their tongues, in fact, are even more spectacular than a snake's, for they're much longer. Both creatures use their tongues for the same purpose, as a sensing device to carry back samples of air, which are savoured in a pair of pits at the back of the palate. One characteristic of some snakes, which monitors fortunately do not share, is venom. None of these lizards is poisonous. They feed on carrion and small, easily caught creatures such as frogs or nestling birds. But this doesn't mean that they don't have to be treated with a certain amount of caution. They have long claws with which they can inflict nasty wounds. Furthermore, if you interfere with them, they get very angry, hiss at you in a very frightening manner, and then lash their tails with considerable force. I certainly didn't relish the thought of being clouted by one. All the same, our failure to film the monitor by Pelican Lagoon rankled. All three of us were determined to try again. We devised a special placing of the boxes in the back of the car so that they would be available at a moment's notice, and not submerged beneath mounds of other equipment. Bob reorganized his gear so that he could assemble it within seconds of taking it from his case. Next time, we were confident, we should be able to flash into action with the speed and efficiency of a gun crew at the Royal Tournament. It seemed too much to hope that we should find the goanna again, but we went down to Pelican Lagoon, just in case he was still there. He was. This time he was sitting in the middle of an open flat that bordered the lagoon.
We stopped some distance short of him. Within seconds, Bob had the microphone and recorder connected up. Charles flung the blimp over the camera. We walked cautiously towards the lizard, over what had appeared to be solid earth, but proved to be a huge drift of powdery dust that puffed into clouds at every footstep. The goanna waited patiently for us. When we were 10 yards away, Charles set down the camera on its tripod and focused.
"Right," he whispered.
"Right," whispered Bob.
"Shoot," I said.
The camera whirred for a few seconds and then stopped. Charles ripped off the blimp and opened the camera. The film had jammed in the gate, filling the inside with a tightly squashed concertina of celluloid. Working as swiftly as he could, Charles tore out the film and took a new roll out of his pocket. I edged my way a little closer to the goanna to try and get the microphone into a better position. The goanna hissed and then suddenly charged me. Startled, I stepped back to avoid him, tripped on one of the tripod legs, and knocked the camera over. It fell open side down into the thick dust. The goanna swung round and continued running down to the lagoon, splashed into the water, and swam away. Charles picked up the camera and blew a huge cloud of dust from its inside. "I don't suppose it'll take more than a couple of hours to clean this lot out," he said bitterly. "And who knows? It might still work." On the morning we set out for our third attempt, the Melbourne butcher, whom we had met on our arrival, decided he would like to come with us. We felt very much on our mettle. To fail yet again, and in his presence, would be unbearably humiliating, and I had a sneaking hope that maybe we should not find the goanna this time, and so escape without our professional skill being put to the test. But the goanna was there, slumbering in the sun within a yard or so of the water's edge. This was the worst position of all, from our point of view, for if he wished, he could disappear into the water within seconds. We stopped the car 20 yards away and held a whispered consultation. The butcher, who had been sitting in the back admiring the view, suddenly leant over our shoulders.
"There she is!" he bellowed. "She's a beaut!"
By now we had perfected our routine. We each completed our job swiftly, and within half a minute all was ready. Cautioning the butcher to stay in the car, we walked slowly down towards the goanna, pausing at each step in order not to frighten the animal into the water before we were close enough to get a good shot.
"Get a move on, mate!" the butcher yelled. "She's not going to hurt you!"
Charles set down the camera once again and focused. Bob, squatting by the recorder, handed me a pole with a microphone slung on the end, and I gingerly lowered it towards the goanna. This roused him. He lifted his head, slid out a good 12 inches of purple forked tongue, inflated his yellow throat, and hissed obligingly into the microphone. It was perfect.
"Shall I stir her up with a bullet?" called the butcher helpfully. "Don't you want a little drama in your movie?"
The goanna heaved itself up onto its feet, took 3 threatening steps towards me, and then, as though to oblige the butcher, lashed its tail ferociously. Charles was able to keep it in focus the whole time. Bob, wearing his headphones, was smiling happily at the recorder. The goanna turned round and strolled arrogantly along the water's edge. Then, as if to display to us all its talents in one sequence, it waded into the lagoon and, with graceful sideways undulations of its body, swam away. We continued filming it until finally it dived and disappeared. We walked back to the car, preening ourselves.
"Piece of cake," said the butcher.
"Yes," I said. "Nothing to it, really." No man need starve in the country around Nolanji. The sparse, dusty bush, the rocky ridges roasting in the sun, may seem barren and inhospitable, but for those who know the land, there's food in abundance. The squat burrawong tree, a type of cycad palm, conceals in its crown of feathery leaves a cone of nuts. The stems of the pink lotus flowers that star the surface of the lagoons lead down to succulent bulbs buried in the mud at the bottom. Even the mangroves and pandanus in season produce fruits that are edible if you know how to cook them. For meat
a man can hunt among the thickets of gum trees for the herds of wallabies. He can catch the huge barramundi fish that cruise lazily in the clear waters of the creeks, or he can draw from the most bountiful larder of all the huge flocks of waterfowl. Yet the country was empty. A few aborigines worked at Nolanji Camp, the men as hunting guides, the women helping in the kitchen and doing the washing. But we saw no aborigines living in the bush. It was not always so. Over 50 years before, this land was the home of the Kakadu people. They were nomads, roaming through the bush in family groups, occasionally assembling in larger numbers to perform their complex ceremonials, but seldom staying in one place for long. At the turn of the century, Paddy Cahill, one of the territory's great pioneers, settled at Owen Pelly, 60 miles from Nolanji on the far bank of the East Alligator River. He came to hunt buffalo commercially for their hides, but soon he had vegetable gardens, plantations of cotton, and a herd of dairy cattle. The Kakadu found employment there, shooting the buffalo and tending the crops. With their pay, they bought knives and sugar, tea and tobacco. Life at Owen Pelly was comparatively easy for them. Family by family, the tribe ceased to wander and stayed close to the station. In 1925, Owen Pelly was taken over by the Church Missionary Society. The new owners did their best to speed the process that Cahill had started and encouraged all the aborigines from the surrounding country to come and live permanently on the station, so that their children could have continuous schooling and the sick and the aged be given medical care. Anchored to the mission by their desire for tobacco and tea, the life of the Kakadu changed radically. Many forgot the old skills and traditions that had been essential for their nomadic existence. They lost their tribal identity among the other people that came to the mission. Today the Kakadu, as a tribe, no longer exists, and their ancient hunting grounds around the South Alligator are deserted. Although they tilled no fields nor built any permanent houses, the Kakadu nonetheless left their mark on the land. For they, like most of the northern tribes, were artists, and their paintings still decorate the cliffs and shelters where once they camped. The hills around Owen Pelly are famous for the wealth and beauty of their paintings, but Alan Stewart knew of rock galleries close at hand, and rich with drawings, which had only recently been discovered by Europeans, and which few outsiders had ever seen. To reach them, we drove for a mile or so along the track that leads to Owen Pelly, and then branched off it southwards, bumping and crashing through the bush towards a rock mountain that towered 600 feet above the scrub, like a great stone fortress. We drove around its base for half an hour, weaving our way between the trees, sometimes having to knock over smaller saplings with our bumper in order to clear a path. At its southwestern end, the foot of the mountain was cluttered with gigantic boulders the size of houses. Some lay several yards from the cliff, others leaned against it to form caves. The main rock wall rose up above us in a series of towers and battlements, split here and there by deep cracks. Alan stopped the car at a place where the cliff leaned outwards to form a shallow, open shelter. The rock was grey, streaked with brown and black where water had trickled down the face, but the interior wall of the shelter was dramatically different. From ground level to a height of 8 or 10 feet, it glowed with designs in white, yellow, and rust red. It took some time for our eyes to make sense out of the tangle of lines and shapes. Then we realized that in the center, dominating the shelter, stood a line of almost life-size human figures, painted in white and neatly outlined with red ochre. They appeared to be wearing headdresses, or else their hair had been arranged in an elaborate coiffure, for their tiny white featureless faces were surrounded by large discs of red, patterned by a few radiating lines in yellow. Most had bangles or bindings on their wrists and upper arms. They were female, for large, stylized breasts swelled sideways across their armpits. The lower part of their thin, attenuated bodies were rubbed and faded, but we could just distinguish that the feet of some of them had been painted. Not with their soles horizontal, as though standing on the ground, but hanging downwards, so that the figures seemed to be floating in the air, like saints around the walls of a Byzantine church. Among them pranced a slightly different being. It was portrayed in movement, its knees slightly bent. It lacked breasts, yet it was without male genitals. Its arms, instead of hanging by its side like those of the female figures, were crossed in front of its torso, and it was without a headdress, its face being simply a large white oval. Its thighs were crisscrossed with white lines, as though adorned for a corroboree. And we could see that the legs of some of the female figures, though faded, were similarly decorated. Above these images swam a huge barramundi fish. This was painted in extraordinary detail. The artist had shown not merely the external appearance of the fish as he saw it, but the reality of the creature as he knew it to be. For over the white silhouette of the fish's body, he had drawn in red its gullet, its stomach, and its gut. It was an X-ray picture. Above the female figures, we found a naive drawing of an ancient-looking pistol. Elsewhere, we discovered pictures of muskets and sabres, sailing ships and steamers with twin funnels pouring smoke. Had the artists painted these things for some ritual reason, or had they done so merely to amuse themselves, and to show their companions the latest wonders that they had seen maybe on one of their walkabouts to the coast 50 miles away? The most vivid of all the images, however, were for me not the bizarre portraits of spirits, nor the naturalistic sketches of animals, but two simple handprints, which partly underlay the pistol. One of the men who had come here had dipped his right hand in red ochre and pressed his palm on the rock. Another had done similarly alongside and had left, in addition, the imprint of his wrist and forearm. These two human hands, reaching upwards from among the weird supernatural beings that they may well have designed, poignantly evoked the presence of these artists, who had come here, with motives we could only guess at, to execute their mysterious drawings. We scrambled among the rocks, exploring the caves with torches, climbing up the cliffs to look at small groups of paintings in high corners. We found pictures of goannas and crocodiles, turtles and kangaroos, and a huge, graceful dolphin. Some had been painted in sections of the cliff that, even allowing for the agility of the aborigines, seemed almost impossible to reach. Maybe a ledge had fallen away since the drawings were made, which would be some evidence of their antiquity. Or perhaps the artist attached so much importance to their work and to the positioning of their paintings that they had gone to the trouble of building a ladder or a scaffold. While I was searching for more, I peered down a narrow rock cleft. There, wedged between the rock walls, staring back at me from empty eye sockets, lay a bleached human skull. Leg bones and ribs were scattered beneath it. Nearby, propped against the cliff face by the fork of a long branch, I found a bundle of folded canvas. It contained a few polished pebbles, a rectangular piece of wood cross-hatched with ochre lines, a woven tassel so rotted by age that it fell to pieces in my hand, and a small, battered tobacco tin. Its lid printed with a florid Victorian trademark of a firm that doubtless had long since gone out of business. This must have been the dead man's swag, his most cherished possessions that, after his funeral rites were completed, had been left here close to his bones. The tassel was a pubic cover, the only clothing that Kakadu men ever wore. No doubt the pathetically tawdry tin was a rare and highly valued treasure. The pebbles and the painted piece of wood were extremely sacred ceremonial objects, the most important and intimate of an aborigine's belongings, which only a few privileged people would have been allowed to see while their owner was alive. I wrapped them up again in the tattered canvas and put them back as I had found them. Of all the animals around Nulanji, we expected the buffalo to be the easiest to film.
We were wrong. There were plenty of them, and they were easy to find. Often we spotted them in the distance, half hidden in the bush, and had we been hunting, it would not have been difficult to shoot them with a rifle. But when we tried to get closer to photograph them, they soon smelt or heard us and cantered away deeper into the bush. By using our longest telephoto lens, we managed to get shots of them wallowing in the centre of the marshes, half a mile from the shore, tended by their faithful flocks of egrets. But photographically, these were poor pictures, for the heat reflected from the surface of the swamp made the air above tremble so much that the image of the buffaloes wavered like a reflection in the rippled surface of water. To get the intimate shots we wanted, uncluttered by intervening branches and bushes, we should have to be really close to the animals, and neither the buffalo nor we showed much desire to reach such a situation. By this time, we had been joined by a team of three zoologists from Canberra, who were making a survey of the animals in selected parts of Arnhem Land. One of them, Harry Frith, had carried out pioneer research on the magpie geese here at Nolangi several years before. He knew the area well and understood buffalo. "Let's drive out in the car," he suggested. "When we find a group of buffs, you and Charles can hop out with the cameras and hide yourselves. Then Bob and I will drive on, circle the herd, and approach it from the other side. We'll chase the buffs toward you, and provided you don't do anything silly, you'll get all the shots you want." It seemed a good idea. 5 miles from the camp, we found the largest herd that we'd seen so far. It was difficult to estimate its numbers, for the animals were a considerable distance from us, and we could distinguish nothing more than a group of brown shapes moving slowly between the trees. We guessed that there were probably 100 or so. To the left of us lay a bog. To the right, the ground rose in a rocky ridge. In the middle of the corridor of flat land that stretched between stood a dead gum tree with a hollow trunk. Harry drew up alongside it. Charles and I quickly slipped out of the door on the far side from the herd and hid ourselves behind the tree. Within seconds the car drove on. The buffalo could not possibly have seen us emerge. The wind was blowing from them to us, so it was very unlikely that they could catch our scent. Everything was working perfectly. The hollow trunk was sufficiently spacious to accommodate one of us, and furthermore there was a small hole near the ground from which we could observe the country ahead. I peered through this spy hole while Charles squatted outside with the camera. We could hear the car rattling away somewhere to our right. So far, I could detect no sign of disturbance among the distant buffalo. As the noise of the car faded, the bush around us returned to life. A small lizard crept out from beneath a piece of bark and resumed its hunt for flies. A flock of brightly coloured finches swept across and settled, twittering, on a nearby bush, oblivious of us. We sat stock still. In the distance, we heard the faint blare of the car's horn. Harry and Bob must have succeeded in reaching the far side of the herd and were already beginning to drive them towards us. I crouched inside the tree, watching the buffalo. Charles checked the camera. Everything was ready. Through the spy hole, I saw the leaders of the herd walking slowly, directly towards us, plainly heading down the corridor, just as we had hoped they would. As yet, they were not seriously alarmed by the car, and were cautiously taking avoiding action. When they discovered that the car was right on their heels and actually pursuing them, no doubt the whole herd would break into a gallop and come straight towards us. Protected by the tree, we should be as safe as if we were standing on a traffic island in a busy city street during the rush hour, and the pictures we should get would be most exciting. Close-up of hooves in the swirling dust, rolling eyes, frothing muzzles, and a forest of savage horns sweeping by within a few feet of the lens. Charles braced himself against the tree. Closer they came. The leaders were now trotting, their heads held nervously in the air. Away to the left, a small flock of white cockatoos came flying towards us. They could not have noticed us, for they settled on one of the branches of our tree, directly above our heads. Now we could hear the drumming of the buffalo's hooves and the roar and hoots of the car behind them.
The leaders of the herd were a mere 50 yards away and were coming straight for us at a canter. Charles dared not peer round the tree, for to reveal himself at this moment might ruin everything. Leaning against a trunk, he put the camera to his eye. Suddenly, one of the cockatoos on the branch above peered down and saw us. It craned its neck as though unable to believe its eyes, and then let out a piercing shriek. Its companions looked down too, and added their strident voices to its outraged squawkings. Through my observation hole, I saw the leading buffaloes hesitate momentarily in their stride, and then swing round to the left in alarm. Those immediately behind them followed, and the whole herd splashed into the marsh and disappeared among the pandanus. We had not been able to take a single shot of them. It was the first of many times that our presence was betrayed and our photographic plans ruined by cockatoos, the most inquisitive, keen-eyed and loud-mouthed sentinels in the bush. Yorkie Billy felt sure that we would never succeed in getting the film we wanted of buffalo anywhere close to the camp.
"Oh, they're too scary round here," he said. "Too many blokes been taking pot shots at 'em."
He recommended the plains around Cannon Hill, just a few miles short of Owen Pelly to the east.
"Big mobs of buff up there. You can get a good look at 'em, 'cause it's nice open country."
Cannon Hill had another attraction, as it and a nearby outcrop called O'Beary was said to have some of the most beautiful cave paintings in the whole of Australia. Cannon Hill was 70 miles away, and to film both the paintings and the buffalo would doubtless take us several days. We decided to carry enough stores to last us for a week in case we got into difficulties. The limiting factor, however, would not be food, but water. Alan Stewart lent us 2 empty 8-gallon drums that had once held methylated spirits. We washed them out and filled them with water and slung 2 more canvas water bags from the front of the car. It was all we had room for. Provided we did not have to use too much of it in the car's radiator or waste it on washing ourselves, it should last the 3 of us for some time. The track to Owen Pelly was largely a creation of the lorry drivers who every few weeks during the dry season drove out to the mission with stores. Often it split into 3, and we soon learned that it was foolish to drive straight on, and much safer to take one of the side branches, for they implied that ahead lay a patch of badly rutted mud, a tree that had fallen across the road, or some other obstacle that the lorry drivers had simply bypassed by bulldozing for themselves yet another twist in the track. We forded several creeks that at this time of the year were no more than trickles linking a chain of brown pools. Soon we had passed the white fortress of Nolanji Rock away to our right. The track wound ahead of us for mile after mile, and behind us we trailed a swirling plume of dust. At last, after 3 hours, the bush suddenly came to an end, and we emerged onto the edge of a wide open plain. This, a few months before, like the flats bordering the Nolanji swamps, had been covered by a shallow lagoon. Now it was a continuous carpet of deep, iron-hard pockmarks and ruts made by the trampling of buffalo. On the far horizon shimmered a long stretch of silver-blue water with bushes mirrored in its surface. Had we been travellers racked by thirst, the sight would certainly have sent us out across the scorching plains to refill our water bottles at this providential lagoon. But it did not exist. It was a mirage. The still air, undisturbed by any wind, had formed an extremely hot layer close to the ground, which was acting as a mirror. It reflected the blue, cloudless sky from above, and, by refraction, twisted the images of trees far on the other side of the plains, so that, to our eyes, they appeared to be bordering the illusory lake. Away to the right of the mirage, the far side of the plain was bordered by a line of cliffs, like Nolanji Rock, but free of vegetation at their base. A long stone finger projected horizontally from the face of one of them, like a gun from the side of a man of war. This, we judged, must obviously be Cannon Hill, in which case O'Beary must be one of the smaller outcrops farther down to the right. In the middle of the plains, however, we saw something that was more immediately exciting. A swarm of black dots clustered around a brownish patch of mud. I looked at them through binoculars. They were buffalo. Here, at last, was our chance of getting, in safety, the close-up shots that we wanted so badly. With luck, we should be able to drive towards the herd and film without even getting out of the car, and we had already discovered that the beasts often ignored a car and only took fright at the sight of a walking human figure. Charles took out the camera. Slowly, we rattled across the corrugated plain. We were still nearly a mile away, and the herd was taking no notice of us. Here and there, as we drove towards them, we came to a long, curving depression, marking the bed of a stream that had meandered across the plain until it was sucked dry by the sun. We crossed two of these without any trouble. When we were only half a mile away from the buffalo, we came to a third. We dipped down into it, accelerated to pull ourselves up the other side. The engine roared, but the car stopped moving. The rear wheels had broken through the hard crust and were spinning in soft blue mud. The buffalo was still ignoring us. To free the car would certainly involve a great deal of digging and pushing. Probably we should also have to unload all the baggage as well in order to lighten the chassis. The buffalo could certainly see us, and all its activity might well alarm them sufficiently to make them prudently stroll away into the bush out of sight. We should have missed a marvellous opportunity. On the other hand, we were not yet close enough to get good shots of them. It seemed unwise to walk up to them carrying a heavy tripod and camera, for if they charged, we should have to choose between abandoning the camera and leaving it to be trampled and tossed by their horns, or trying to run back to the car and being so encumbered with the camera that we should be caught ourselves. There was, however, a compromise. I could walk towards the herd and see how close I could get before they seemed to resent my presence. If they charged before I was within camera range of them, then, unimpeded by gear, I could race back and seek safety in the car, which, although it was stuck and immovable, was at least something to dodge behind. But if, as I hoped, I could get sufficiently close without disturbing them, then Charles could join me with the camera. "Don't forget what Yorkie said," advised Bob with relish. "If they come for you, just fall flat on your face." I was within 150 yards of them before they even raised their heads. Slowly, I advanced. All of them were now staring at me, but none seemed in the least aggressive. I remembered Charles's anxiety to avoid heat shimmer and stepped a little closer. When I was 60 yards away, a particularly large bull took several paces towards me, swung his head up and down, and shook his horns. I stood still and tried to remember, without looking back and taking my eyes off the bull, how far away I was from the car. The calculation of how fast I could run and how long it would take the buffalo to overtake me seemed a rather complicated sum. I began to lose confidence. Yorkie's method of escape began to seem less attractive than ever. The big bull took a few more menacing steps towards me and shook his horns again. The beasts were certainly not going to allow us to film from this position. I had come too close. Before I took ignominiously and probably unsuccessfully to flight, it seemed better to try and forestall a charge by bluffing. I jumped into the air, waved my arms, and shouted. The bull reared back, swung round, and cantered away. Suddenly I felt very brave and ran after it to consolidate my victory, yelling loudly. The whole herd galloped away in a cloud of dust. I stopped running and turned round to return and apologise to Charles for having ruined our chances of filming. To my astonishment, he wasn't in the car at all, but standing midway between it and me. He had been following some 20 yards behind me and had filmed the entire proceedings. Freeing the Land Rover took us nearly 2 hours. The wheels had sunk so deeply that the back axle was resting on the ground and the springs were buried. We crawled beneath the car and, lying on our stomachs, clawed the mud away with our hands. In order to give the wheels something on which to grip, we returned half a mile to the bush on the edge of the plain, felled some saplings, dragged them back to the car, and thrust them beneath the tyres. Bob started the engine. Charles and I levered desperately with the poles beneath the back axle. The wheels spun, there was an unpleasant smell of hot rubber, and then the wheels gripped on the branches. Valiantly, the truck hauled herself out of her self-made pit. We were free. We drove straight for Obiri, for here, Alan had said, were some extremely impressive paintings. He had not exaggerated. The rock was stratified horizontally, and on the western side one massive leaf projected some 30 feet into the air to form a great ceiling, some 50 feet above the ground. The wall at the back of this natural open hall was covered by a magnificent frieze of red barramundi fish. Each of these monsters was 4 or 5 feet long, with its head tilted downwards. Like the ones we had seen at Nolanji, they were painted in the X-ray style, but their detail was even more elaborate. The backbone, the fin rays of the tail, the lobes of the liver, the bands of muscle along the back, the gullet and the gut, all were shown. Among these noble fish were snake-necked turtles, kangaroos, goannas, emus, and geometrical patterns. The design stretched for 50 feet in a band 6 feet high, and had been painted so thickly and so many times that the heads and tails of previous paintings protruded from beneath the later ones. Excitedly we explored the cave, calling out to one another as we found a new variation, a different kind of animal, or a particularly magnificent example. It was too late to start filming, for within an hour it would be dark, and we had not yet made camp. Although there was no water here, we decided to spend the night by the cave. It was an idyllic and impressive campsite, the huge rock behind us, the plains stretching away on one side, and the bush on the other. Apart from its lack of water, it had only one disadvantage. It was plagued by flies. They settled everywhere in black, crawling swarms, on our foreheads, our hands, our lips, and our eyes. Although they were quite harmless, the sensation of their feet on our skin was almost as irritating as if they had been stinging us. That night I cooked an omelette, and as we sat round the fire eating, the flies alighted on our plates and clung to the food so persistently that merely waving a hand wouldn't dislodge them. The only way to avoid swallowing a dozen or so with every mouthful was to blow hard and continuously on each morsel of food until it was close to our lips, and then thrust it quickly into our mouths before any more of the hateful insects could settle on it again. We assembled our low safari beds, erected the tent of mosquito netting above each of them, and with considerable relief crawled beneath, safe at last from the attentions of the flies. I read for some time by the light of a torch. As I lay there, I could see nothing of the outside world, for the light of my torch illuminated the mosquito netting and made it seem solid. I felt as though I was lying in a small white room. Then I snapped off the light, and immediately the white walls disappeared, and I looked up into infinity and the glory of the Milky Way. Ahead of me, Obiri Rock loomed against the bespangled sky. Even now it was very hot, and I lay naked on my sleeping bag. I awoke some time after midnight. The darkness was full of noises. Occasionally there was a shrill scream. I guessed it was some bird, but I couldn't recognize the call. A scuffling came from where we had left the stores. Some small creature, maybe a rat, was investigating our larder. Further away there was an even louder rustling in a patch of pandanus, followed by a heavy thump.
I say, it was Bob. What's that noise down there?
Fruit bats, I expect, I whispered back reassuringly. I wasn't quite sure why I whispered.
It's a bit loud for fruit bats, isn't it?
There was another sustained rustle, followed by a thud.
"How does a fruit bat make a thumping noise?"
"That's the fruit falling. Go back to sleep."
But Bob's questions had raised doubts in my mind. If it wasn't a fruit bat among the pandanus 15 yards from where we were sleeping, what was it? I realised that I wouldn't be able to go to sleep until I knew. I clambered out of the mosquito net and, naked, with a torch in my hand, picked my way barefoot towards the pandanus. As I arrived, there was an explosion of sound and a huge shape erupted from the thicket and crashed away into the darkness. It was a buffalo. The next morning we drove along the line of cliffs, looking for paintings. There were so many outcrops of rocks, such a complex of tumbled boulders, that it was difficult at first to know where to search. But slowly we began to recognise the sort of site the Aborigines had favoured for their work. An overhang, a rock corner shielded from the rain, a cave, a particularly unusual rock formation like the arch of a monolith, such places were always worth investigating, and usually we found that they had been decorated. The surest indication of all was circular pits on the top of slabs or flat boulders. These were the places where the artists had prepared their paints, grinding the mineral ochres into powder with a pebble. The very existence of these pits, which must have taken many years to produce in the hard quartzite, was evidence that these sites were not selected as a passing fancy, but had such a significance to the artists that they visited them year after year to renew the designs or add fresh ones. As we explored, we sometimes caught sight of little black rock wallabies, miniature kangaroos the size of terriers, that scampered away from us, often leaping up sheer rock faces with the most astonishing agility. Although we wandered a long way from our camp at Obiri, we found the most interesting and aesthetically satisfying of all paintings in a small rock shelter opposite the main cave. It represented a line of hunters. Each figure was armed with one or more spears. Some, in addition, carried spear throwers, fans of goose feathers, baskets hung from their shoulders, or a string bag slung from their necks. There was nothing stereotyped in the way in which they were shown. Each differed from every other in posture and in the weapons and accoutrements that he carried. They were painted in a style quite different from that of the great X-ray Barramundi. The huntsmen's bodies were not shown in full detail, but merely indicated by single lines scratched in white through the reddened surface of the rock. Whereas the fish had been placed haphazardly, one overlapping the other, these figures formed a balanced rectangular composition. And while the fish and the other animals had been static and monumental, these were full of life, running with springing strides. Together they formed a hunting scene full of excitement and vitality. No one knows which tribe made these drawings. The Aborigines who live in this country today are emphatic that neither they nor their fathers did so. They explain the drawings by saying that they were executed by a spirit people, the Mimi, and that these are their self-portraits. The Mimi, as can be seen from their pictures, have bodies as thin as reeds and so frail that they can't venture out in a high wind for fear of being buckled and bent. They hunt and eat, cook on fires and hold corroborees, just like Aborigines. Their home is among the rocky cliffs, but no one ever sees them, for they're very shy and have an acute sense of hearing. When they detect a man approaching, they simply blow on the surface of the rock, which splits open at their command. The Mimi slip inside, and the rocks close behind them. They are said to be harmless, happy spirits, but drawn across this hunting scene were the images of two malevolent witches, the Namarakain women. These, like the Mimi, had stick-like bodies, but they were painted in red and had triangular faces. They, the Aborigines say, steal men's livers, roast them and eat them. Between their hands they held a loop of string, a magical device with which they can miraculously transport themselves over great distances during the night. We filmed many of these paintings, illuminating them with small battery lamps. The Great Barramundi Frieze was far too large to be artificially lit, but it was on the western side of O'Beary, and for a short period of 10 minutes each evening, the almost horizontal rays of the setting sun struck the inside wall of the cave and flooded it with light. This was the time to film it. As sections of the wall were confusingly thick with paintings, we decided that I should walk along the length of the panel, pointing out the different images and describing them in words. This, once more, would require synchronous recording. We prepared to tackle this sequence on our last evening in camp. Bob tested his equipment, and Charles set up his camera well in advance. We rehearsed the movements that I should make as I walked along the rock face. It was absolutely vital that we made no mistake, for we couldn't delay our return to Norlanji any longer. We had almost exhausted our water supply, and if we failed to complete the shot satisfactorily that evening, we should have to leave without any film at all of the painted Barramundi. With everything ready, we waited as the sun sank lower and lower, and its light slowly crept up the inside wall of the cave, the redness of its rays enhancing the rich colours of the ochre fish. At last the moment came when the entire height of the frieze was illuminated. We now had 10 minutes in which to take the shot. We started, and almost immediately Bob called out in exasperation. The recorder, inexplicably, was producing a loud electronic howl which was ruining the recording. Rapidly he dismantled it and spread it out in pieces on the top of a boulder. No connection seemed to be broken, and Bob could find no obvious fault. He assembled it again, without putting it back in its case, and when he did so he noticed that, having been standing in the sun, it was quite hot. Maybe this was the fault, for some of the transistors, which then were only just coming into general use, were known not to work above a certain temperature. Bob put the machine in the shade of a boulder and fanned it with his hat. Slowly the screaming noise died in his headphones. We completed the shot, with Bob still fanning frantically, as Charles filmed. A minute or so after we stopped the camera, the sun dipped behind the bush, and the cave was in twilight. To find Aborigines who still produce designs comparable with those emblazoned on the rocks around Norlanji and Cannon Hill, we had to go into Arnhem Land, the vast slab of territory that lay on the far side of the East Alligator River. Bounded to the south by the Roper River and to the north and east by the sea, it's as big as the whole of Scotland. No road crossed it. A mere handful of explorers had traversed it. The only parts of it to have been mapped in any detail on the ground were the immediate surroundings of the half-dozen mission and government stations strung out along its coast. It's the wildest, least explored tract of country in the whole of northern Australia. No large-scale attempt to settle the country has ever been made, and while in the temperate south of the continent great cities grew and the rolling grasslands were cleared of Aborigines to make way for cattle and sheep, Arnhem Land and its people were largely left alone. As a result, it's here that the Aborigines have survived in greater numbers than anywhere else in Australia, here that they've had the least compulsion or opportunity to change their ways and conform to the conditions of life dictated by the white man. In 1931, after the conscience of Australians had at last been roused by the tragic history of the first inhabitants of their continent, the whole of Arnhem Land was declared an Aboriginal reserve. Traders and prospectors could only travel in its valleys, crocodile shooters could only sail up its rivers if they had special permits, and these were not freely given. We had applied for such a permit when we had been in Darwin, and had received one to visit Maningrida. Of all the settlements, this offered us the best chance of finding painting fulfilling its original tribal function. It was the most recently established, having been opened officially by the Government Welfare Department a mere 2 years before, and the Aborigines were therefore still little affected by European ways. Furthermore, it was the only settlement without a missionary. If painting had any ritual function, then the presence of a man dedicated to weaning the Aborigines away from their tribal religions must inevitably distort the nature of their art. No one had yet reached Maningrida by land. A small ship took in supplies every few weeks by sea, but the most convenient way of getting there was by air. Accordingly, we chartered a small single-engined plane to come from Darwin and to fly us over. As we took off from Nalanje, the pilot swung the little craft round and flew low over the swamps so that we could have a last look at the country in which we'd been working for the past few weeks. As we approached, the dots that speckled the glinting coffee-coloured lagoons spread black and white wings and seemed suddenly to double in numbers as they detached themselves from their racing black shadows. We banked again to leave the geese in peace and headed east over Arnhem Land. Now it was easy to see why this brutal, sun-ravaged country had repelled settlers for so long. Naked plateaus of sandstone, deeply dissected by ravines and scored by long straight faults, stretched endlessly ahead. As we droned over them, I amused myself by trying to devise a route along which one might drive a team of pack horses or even a truck. Each time I traced with my eye an obvious eastward-heading valley, where the going seemed tolerably straightforward, it ended suddenly in a savage scarp, or twisted away at right angles to the direction I had wanted to pursue. It was like a child's printed puzzle, which invites you to trace with a pencil a path through a maze and reach the treasure in the centre, except that here there was no route without obstacles, and no visible sign of any treasure. As so often in the puzzles, the least difficult way for an earthbound traveller to reach Maningrida was obviously the longest, to travel around the coast in a boat. The pilot leaned over his shoulder and yelled at me, "If the engine went crook now, what do you reckon we'd do?" I looked at the landscape, appalled at the thought. "Crash? Head for that little patch over there," he shouted, pointing ahead to a minute open rectangle of land, relatively free of bush, but encircled by crags. "We've got enough height to make it, even without an engine, and I reckon it's just about big enough for me to put her down. Though how the hell they'll get in to fetch us, I don't know. I always try to remember places like that on overland trips. Comforting." We droned on. The landscape below was now unrelieved rock. I tapped him on the shoulder. "What would you do if she packed up now?" He looked contemplatively on either side. "Pray," he shouted. After just over an hour of flying, we sighted the coast. The pilot pointed to a river that coiled tortuously into an estuary. On its far bank, dwarfed by the surrounding wilderness, we saw a pathetically small cluster of toy-like buildings. This was Maningrida. 5 years before, when the ships of the welfare department ran their keels into the sand at the mouth of the Liverpool River, there was nothing in front of them but mangrove. Since then, building machinery and bags of cement, tractors and supplies of food had been ferried every few weeks round the coast from Darwin, 300 sea miles away. Gangs of carpenters and bricklayers had come to work in monastic isolation. Already they had completed a school, a hospital, communal kitchens, storehouses, and accommodation for the staff. Gardens, a parade ground, and a football field had been cleared, and the Australian flag flew from a tall mast. The people for whose benefit all this work was being done were encamped on the outskirts of the station. Some had erected simple shelters of bark along the edge of the long, curving beach. These were the Gunavigi, a tribe of people who seldom strayed far from the sea. The men knew how to make dugout sailing canoes and used them to fish for turtles and barramundi. The women searched daily along the edge of the reefs at low tide for shellfish and crabs. On the other side of the station, among the thick, straggling eucalyptus scrub, lived a different tribe, the Burrada. Unlike the Gunavigi, they knew little of the sea and normally lived inland, gathering roots and hunting for bandicoots and wallaby in the rocky, hot scrub. Some of these people wore ragged European clothes, but many of the men were naked except for loincloths, a simple square of material passed between the legs, the corners knotted at each hip. In complexion, they were a shiny, ebony black, of an intensity unequalled by any other people I had seen. Their limbs were so thinly fleshed that they seemed painfully emaciated. In fact, however, this lankiness is typical of Aboriginal physique. Their hair was not fuzzy, like an African Negro's, but silky and often curling and wavy. That afternoon, Mick Ivory, the superintendent, showed us round. He was emphatic that Maningrida was far from being a charitable institution, although clearly it cost the government a great deal to run. If an Aborigine joined the settlement, he must work, and there was work here of a sufficient variety to suit everyone, cutting up logs of cypress pine at the sawmill, mixing cement for the gangs of European contractors who were still putting up new buildings, tending the gardens where pawpaw and bananas, tomatoes, cabbages and melons grew under arching sprays of water, clearing and planting land with new grass that, Ivory hoped, would soon be thick enough to support a herd of cattle. Girls could help in the hospital, women in the kitchens. Old men could chop sticks of firewood. In return, every man and his family would be given regular meals and pay. With the money, he could buy tea and tobacco, flour and knives at the station canteen. His children could attend school, and soon, as building work proceeded, there would be small wooden houses for many. There was medical care for everyone. Two European nursing sisters ran the hospital under the supervision of a doctor who flew in from Darwin once a fortnight and could be summoned at a few hours' notice to deal with emergencies. Difficult cases he could take back with him in the plane to Darwin Hospital. Many of the Aborigines here had known something of the white man's ways before the settlement was founded. They'd worked on board pearling luggers, had visited Darwin, or had spent some time at one of the missions elsewhere along the coast. But some had drifted in from the surrounding country and had decided to stay. Every now and then a new family of Myalls, wild Aborigines who had never lived on any settlement of any sort, came and camped close to the station. From the security of the bush, they watched broodingly the strange things that their countrymen were doing on the station. Mick Ivory would then send men out to try and encourage them to join the station. Sometimes the invitation was met with abusive jeers, and the Myalls left. But sometimes they accepted and came in. For a fortnight they would be given free food with everyone else. No small temptation when game was scarce. But after this period, they must start work or leave. "But it seldom comes to that," Mick said. "After all, turning them away achieves nothing. If they stay, we can casually persuade them to work all right. The trouble is that a lot of them don't want to live on the station under any circumstances and are only too ready to go back into the bush." Soon after we arrived, Mick took us down to the Burrada encampment. He had led us to a shelter of branches, reinforced with a few pieces of bark and cloth that stood some way apart from the others, on the fringe of the scrub. In its shade sat an elderly man, naked but for a grubby loincloth, his knees on the ground and his legs crossed in front of him, in a position impossible for anyone to achieve who has not squatted in this way throughout his life. His chest and upper arms were marked with long scars of the wounds he had accepted during the initiations of his youth. He grinned as we arrived, showing his white teeth, ground down to near the gums by a lifetime of eating gritty foods.
"G'day, boss."
"G'day, Magani. These men," Ivory pointed to us, "want to see blackfella painting. I tell 'em you're the best painter in Maningrida. That's right?" Magani nodded.
"That's right, boss,"
he said, acknowledging the remark, not as a compliment nor as a personal opinion, but merely as an accepted and indisputable fact.
"Will you show 'em how to paint?"
Magani looked at us with his black eyes for some seconds.
"All right."
We didn't stay long with Magani on that first visit, and indeed, although we called at his shelter every morning and afternoon for the next few days to sit and smoke and talk, we left our camera behind. He was engaged in painting a series of kangaroos on a thin rectangle of bark, but there was no urgency to complete it, apparently, and he was always ready to talk as he worked. He spoke in pidgin, but it was difficult at first to understand him, for the rhythms of his speech, his pronunciation of individual words, and the idiosyncratic stressing of syllables were bafflingly unfamiliar to me. As our ears became accustomed to his talk, I endeavoured to speak in the same way, sometimes falling back on the pidgin I'd learned in New Guinea. The two versions differed considerably, and I suspect that, in my efforts to make myself understood, I confused Makani more than if I'd spoken simple, straightforward English. But perhaps irrationally it seemed discourteous not to make some attempt to modify my own speech to match the manner in which he found it easiest to talk himself. Primitive and inadequate though our conversations were, I soon realised that Makani had a considerable sense of humour. One afternoon, Bob Charles and I were sitting in his shelter, watching him paint. Two other men had joined us and were squatting at the back of his shelter. Suddenly, one of them shrieked and leapt to his feet. "Shanake! Shanake!" he yelled, and stabbed his finger at a small emerald-green snake that was sliding from beneath a pile of bark fragments onto the earth floor. We all jumped up except Makani. While everybody else hurled sticks at the reptile, he sat immobile, his brush loaded with ochre and poised over the bark. At last the snake was killed and thrown out of the shelter. Makani moved for the first time since the commotion had started. He turned to me, smiled beatifically, and pronounced, with an impeccable Australian accent and the timing of a born comedian, two short words of appalling obscenity. "Makani," I said in mock horror, "in bad words." "Oh, sorry." He rolled his eyes upwards and pointed to the sky. "Sorry," he repeated in a louder voice, as though apologising to the heavens. Then he looked back at me. "No, he all right," he said brightly, with exaggerated relief. "Today no Sunday." And he shrieked with laughter. "Makani, where you learn those bad words?" I asked. "Fanny Bay." Fanny Bay is the prison in Darwin. "What for you go Fanny Bay?" "Oh, long time back, one fella, him bad bloke, me kill him." "Where you kill him?" Makani leaned over and jabbed his finger under my ribs. "Just there," he explained in matter-of-fact tone. "He bad bloke, me gotta kill him." Makani had a particular companion, Jarabili, who helped him with his paintings and spent a great deal of time in Magana's shelter. Jarabili was a younger, taller man with a lantern jaw and blazing eyes. He was a sombre character, with none of Magana's relish for jokes. Everything we said to him was always taken very seriously and pondered upon. Once I asked him the name of an animal in his own language. This interest he construed as being an indication that I had ambitions to speak Burrada fluently, and for a long time afterwards he came to look for me every evening and insisted that we sat down together while he dictated a lengthy vocabulary. Then he would make me put away my notes and would test me on the list that he'd given me the previous evening. I was a poor pupil, but Jarabili was both persistent and patient, and though I never learnt enough to carry on the simplest conversation, I was able every now and then to inject a Burrada word into my pidgin, and this was enough to bring a rare smile to Jarabili's face. The shelter where we all spent so much time was not the only one that Makani owned. It was merely the one in which he did his paintings. His wife and children lived in another, closer to the station, but Makani only went there to sleep and to have his meals. He also had another, away in the bush, where he kept his dogs. One of his favourite bitches, he told us, had just produced pups. "No, bring 'em here," he said. "Maybe Mikaiberi, he shoot 'em." The station had recently been infested with half-starved dogs, and Mikaiberi had been forced to take strong measures. Makani seemed to have a haunting suspicion that we might take the same attitude, and even though he was proud of the pups, he was obviously unwilling to show them to us. We didn't press the matter. Sometimes, when we came to look for him, he was neither at the studio shelter nor with his family. On one of these occasions we found Jarabili. He looked uncomfortable when we asked where Makani was. "Oh, he gone bush. Make him business." Business was the word he used for all matters associated with religion. We didn't press that inquiry either. None of the Barada people had any great number of material belongings. The nomadic existence that they had led until recently had not allowed them to develop the obsession to possess things that so bedevils many of the rest of us. A dilly bag, an elongated woven pouch decorated with long tassels, hung at the back of Magana's painting shelter. He also owned a few spears and woomera, or spear-thrower, a long slat of wood shaped into a handle at one end and fitted with a spike at the other. The spike slots into a notch at the end of a spear, and the woomera virtually doubles the length of a man's arm, thus increasing the leverage on the spear and greatly augmenting the power with which he can hurl it. Magani also possessed a pipe, a slender piece of hollow wood with a small metal cup at one end, for the tobacco, a type known as a Makassar pipe, for it had been introduced to the Aborigines centuries before by Indonesian traders. The stem of this pipe was always kept bandaged with a strip of frayed, dirty cloth. Why this was so, we were not to discover for some time. Jarabili owned a didgeridoo, the branch of a tree hollowed out by termites, which he had smoothed to form a simple trumpet. Sometimes he played this for us, making a throbbing bass drone, into which he was able to introduce rasping crescendos with considerable rhythmic variation. To produce a note at all was difficult enough, but Jarabili was able to sustain the sound for many minutes on end, managing to continue blowing by contracting his cheeks while taking in a breath through his nose to refill his lungs, just as an expert bassoon player is able to do. At last we felt that Magani and Jarabili knew us sufficiently well for us to ask if we might begin filming. Magani agreed to begin a new painting specially for us, so that we could follow every stage of its production. The bark on which he painted came only from one kind of eucalyptus, the stringy bark. We set off together to collect a piece which Magani promised would be a proper big one, so that he could produce a really splendid painting. We borrowed an axe from one of his neighbours, and together we all went off into the bush. Once we reached the bush, stringy bark trees were abundant, but Magani was hypercritical. 9 out of 10 he rejected at a glance. Occasionally he took a tentative chop at a trunk with the axe, but the bark, he said, was too thin, or else it didn't separate freely from the wood beneath. The bark of some was cracked, others had too many knot-holes. Many had already been stripped of their bark for making shelters or paintings. At last, when I was beginning to fear that we should never find a suitable tree, and that Magani, in his anxiety to make a superb painting for us, had set himself too high a standard, he found a tree that seemed to satisfy all his requirements. With the axe, he ringed the trunk around 3 feet from the ground. He propped a fallen branch against the tree, climbed up it, and, gripping the branch with his toes in order to keep his balance, dexterously cut another ring 5 feet above the lower one. Then he cut out a vertical strip joining the two rings, and slowly peeled away an immense sheet, leaving the trunk of the tree naked white and running with sap. Back at camp, he carefully trimmed off the outer fibrous layers of the bark. With these shavings he lit a fire, on which he threw the curling sheet, inner side downwards. The heat was not sufficient to burn the bark, but enough to turn some of its sap into steam and make the whole piece pliable. After a few minutes he put it down on the ground and weighted it with boulders, so that it would harden absolutely flat. This was to be his canvas. He used 4 pigments and showed us where he found each. In the dry, rocky bed of a stream he collected pebbles of limonite, a hydrated iron oxide. Their quality he assessed by scratching them on a boulder. Some left yellow marks, some red, and these kinds he kept. From a pit dug among the mangroves by the shore he obtained a white kaolin. Black he produced by grinding up charcoal. These were the 4 basic colours in his palette. But in addition to the red limonite pebbles, he had another ochre, which was a richer, deeper red. This was not of local origin, but came from somewhere to the south, and was traded from the people in whose tribal territory it occurred. Accordingly, it was very precious, and Magani kept it in his dilly bag, carefully wrapped in a packet of paper bark. One further material was necessary, the fleshy stems of the dendrobium orchid, which grew on the high branches of the gum trees. Magani said he was too old to collect this for himself, and Jarabili was the one who clambered up the trees to gather it. The juice from these stems was to serve as a fixative to prevent the paint from flaking. The sheet of bark had now dried, and painting could begin. Magani put it flat on the ground and sat cross-legged in front of it. By his side he placed a cockle shell and several cigarette tins, all full of water. He ground a red pebble on a small piece of sandstone, tipped the ochre into the cockle shell, and daubed the resulting paint over the bark with his fingers to make a solid red ground for his design. Each figure he roughly outlined with the orchid stem, having chewed its end to make it juicy. For the detailed painting he used three different brushes, a twig with a chewed splayed end, which produced broad lines, another with a bird end, which he used for stippling, and a third with a trailing fibre attached to the tip, with which, by drawing it skilfully and steadily across the bark, he made thin, delicate lines. Slowly and carefully he painted kangaroos and men, fish and turtles. The designs were stylized and simple. In none did he try to represent the exact appearance of an animal. That was unnecessary, for everyone knew what a kangaroo or a man looked like. A spectator was expected to use his own imagination to clothe the images with an appearance of reality. His aim was simply that the nature of the images should be clear, and he ensured that this was so by selecting and emphasizing the particular characteristic that proclaimed identity. Even we, with our untutored eyes, were usually able to recognize the designs. The symbols were precise. His lizards were not simply lizard-like creatures, but geckos or goannas, and quite distinct from crocodiles. His fish were recognizably barramundi or stingray or shark. Some designs, however, were so stylized that no inexperienced person could divine their meaning. Circles with a hump on them, separated by cross-hatching, represented a freshwater lagoon, for the first was the symbol of the lily bulb, and the second the pattern for water. When the image of a long stick was added, representing a woman's digging stick, the scene became one of people out foraging for bulbs in a billabong. Many of his compositions were very detailed, a mosaic of figures enmeshed by the geometrical symbols of sea and sand, clouds and rain. There was no perspective. The tightly organized composition could be viewed several ways up, and in those that contained human figures it was unusual to find one in which all stood the same way. But simple and elementary though his pictures were, they were endlessly interesting. His restricted palette dictated a subtle harmony of colour, and the stark economy of the symbols gave them dignity and power. To our eyes, the pictures had a peculiar beauty. Every man we asked agreed readily that he was a painter. People seemed surprised that we should consider the possibility that a man might not be an artist. On the other hand, if they gained pleasure from painting, it was from the activity, not from the contemplation. For few people seem to derive much enjoyment from looking at other people's work. When the word got around that we were interested in paintings, many brought their barks to us. But few could compare with Magani's. No one painted with such skill, imagination or application as he did. I asked Magani why he painted. He was mystified by the question. His first answer was simply that we had asked him to do so. But he painted before we came to Manangreda. Why? Oh, because Mick Ivory gave him money for the barks, and with that he could buy tobacco at the store. For some time this was the only answer I could extract from him. But it could not be the only one, for Magani and his people, as we knew from the rock paintings and from the records of the early explorers, had been painting long before any white people came here to buy the paintings. Oh, we always been making, was Magani's only reply. When he had finished the big bark painting, which we had photographed at every stage, we sat down together, and I asked him to identify images one by one. Down the centre of the bark were two long shapes with small stubby arms projecting from the sides or the end. Internally they were subdivided into rectangular sections and cross-hatched in white, yellow and red.
"Honey sugar bag," Magali said.
That meant wild honey filling the hollow trunk of a tree. The arms were branches, which, being irrelevant to the main conception, were therefore greatly reduced in size. On one side of this there were three small cameos. This fella, Gonimax, Dillybag, Cut Honey Sugarbag. This man, take him spear, kill him dingo dog. Two woman, one man, make him fire, lie down, go sleep. Above these lay a goanna, a gecko, and a third lizard with red flaps projecting from its neck.
Got him big ear holes, Magani pointed out.
It was a frilled lizard, a magnificent creature we had seen around Nornanji, with a great sheet of skin wrapped round its neck, which it can erect like an Elizabethan ruff. On the other side of the wild honey tree I saw a symbol which mystified me. It was a long rectangle, cross-hatched in the centre section and broadly striped in red, yellow and white at either end. The figure of a man leaned over one end, his face touching the rectangle. Beneath him were drawn two other figures, one dancing and the other apparently striking two sticks together, as singers often do to give themselves a rhythmic accompaniment. I pointed to the rectangle. "What, this one?" Magani so far had been answering loudly and without hesitation. Now he leaned over and whispered hoarsely in my ear.
"Yolongo." "Why you talk so soft?" I whispered back. "Im Yolongo. If we talk loud, young boy, woman, might be hearing me talk his name. Why must they not hear? Yolongor, him secret, him belong business. God made him."
I had little idea what Yolongor could be. Obviously it was connected with ritual, and a subject not to be discussed before uninitiated boys or women. But whether it was a physical object or a spirit or both, I didn't know.
"Where this Yolongor?" "M. Longbush."
"Magani, I know woman, I know young boy. Im all right, me see him?" Magani looked at me hard and scratched his nose.
"All right," he said.
It was this one image on the bark that was to reveal to us the most powerful compulsion that motivated Magani's art, the greatest single force that made him spend his days painting. Magani strode purposefully through the bush. He walked erect, leaning back slightly from his hips, his arms dangling, his bare feet treading unfeelingly on twigs and thorns. Close by the Burrada encampment, the scrub was crisscrossed by paths, but as we went further they thinned out, and soon we were in part of the bush that was evidently largely unfrequented. After half a mile, we arrived at a large shelter of branches. In front of it sat Jarabili. He was doing nothing, just sitting cross-legged, looking into space. As we came close to him, he started visibly and turned his smouldering eyes on us. Magani spoke to him rapidly in Burrada, and the two of them went into the shelter. They bent, cleared away pieces of bark and leaves, and revealed a long pole. Carefully, they brought it out into the sunlight and laid it on the ground.
"Im Yolongor," Magani said.
It was 8 feet long, coloured red, and decorated with a few unfinished symbols of goannas, and it was hollow. One end had been plastered with beeswax to form a mouthpiece. I slowly realised that this was a trumpet, a giant version of the didgeridoo. We knelt down beside it.
"Im talk," said Magani. "Listen."
He lay on his side on the ground, put his mouth to the waxed end, and blew. Yulungur sounded with a deep, sonorous, vibrating roar, much deeper than the note of an ordinary didgeridoo.
"Me come here many time, make him painting," Magani said.
This was where he had been when we had found him missing from the studio shelter, the business to which Jarabili had referred so darkly. A secret was being revealed to us, but we still didn't appreciate its full import. Now that Yulungur had been shown to us, we were permitted to visit the shelter whenever we wished. If no one was there, the trumpet was carefully hidden beneath its shroud of leaves, and we didn't touch it. But usually Magani or Jarabili was sitting beside it, patiently adding more designs. Magani explained that the whole length of the trumpet had to be painted, for soon it was to be used in a great ritual. Discovering the nature of the ceremony and the myth connected with it was a long and slow process. Every day we talked about it, and I wrote down what Magani told me. I recognised the myth as the one which occurs in various forms all over this part of Australia. Many versions of it have been recorded, but as I listened to Magani, I tried to forget all I had read of other people's accounts and listen only to his. I endeavoured not to ask leading questions, nor to force the story into a neat plot, not to require happenings to have causes, not to connect events into the logical sequence of action and consequence demanded by our own fictions. Our own myths, in their original form, are seldom obviously logical. When we first learn them, we accept them unquestioningly as a series of facts, one succeeding another. The story that a snake persuaded an ancestral woman to eat an apple, and thereby deprived a man of the gift of immortality and doomed him to die, is just as divorced from logic as Magani's story. I knew, too, that though I could note down the happenings that Magani related, I could only dimly comprehend the meaning that the story had for him. How could I, to whom the creation myths of my own culture seemed no more than curious allegories, understand Magani's attitude to a story which, to him, was the literal explanation of the origin of his own people and of the very land that he lived in? A story whose facts were so saturated with meaning and awe that the very name of some of the protagonists could not be breathed in the presence of a woman who had no right to the knowledge. His story took place during the dream time, when the earth was flat and featureless, when animals were almost human and people almost gods. Two women, sisters, came up from the south. On one occasion, they camped by a waterhole from which a huge snake emerged. This was Yulungur. He ate the two sisters. He arched into the sky. His body was a rainbow, his tongue lightning, and his voice thunder. From the clouds he called to other serpents elsewhere in the country and told them of all that had happened at the waterhole. The other snakes derided him and called him foolish. It was wrong, they said, to have eaten those women. Chastened, Yulungur returned to the waterhole. There he spat out the women, still alive, and sank once more back into his well. This was only one episode in a long saga which chronicled the doings of the two Wawelak sisters and the Wongar men who came up to look for them after Yulungur had spat them out. In the course of the myth, all the animals of the world were created and named, the rites of circumcision and scarification ordained, the rhythm of the dances and the patterns of the celebratory rites established, the structure of Burrada society, the totems, clans and moieties were also determined, for each man was related to the protagonists in the story, and thus was able to ascertain his status with regard to other men. It was a story as long as the Ring of the Nibelung, as meaningful as the Book of Genesis. Women could never know it in detail, and a man only became aware of it gradually throughout his life. Before his birth, his spirit left the totemic waterhole where his ancestral spirits had first appeared, and went into the womb of his mother. When he was 8 or 9 years old, he was circumcised and introduced to some of the less sacred parts of the story. As he grew up, more and more of it was revealed to him, until at last, as an old man like Magani, he knew the whole meaning of life. At his death, his spirit was freed from his body and returned to the totem place from which it came. Magani and Jarabiri were preparing for the performance of one small episode of the myth in order that the young men who had reached the appropriate age could see the sacred symbols and learn the chants and dances, so reaching another stage in their understanding of the universe. It was the part of the story during which goannas were brought out of the sacred well by Yulungur back to life. Before this could take place, however, much work had to be done on the trumpet. Day after day the two men came to the shelter to continue the painting. Already the trumpet was a sacred object, for once when I stretched my hand across it to pick up something, Jarabiri tut-tutted and reproved me. It was disrespectful to reach across Yulungur in such a fashion. Down the length of the trumpet they portrayed goannas, alternating with the long cross-hatched and striped rectangles that symbolised Yulungur himself. After each one had been completed, work stopped, while Magani lay on his side and softly blew down the trumpet, so that Yulungur roared a series of long, vibrating notes. Jarabiri then took two rhythm sticks and chanted to the serpent, calling his name. Each section of the decoration, it seemed, had to be sung in to make it good. Once, at the end of his chant, Jarabiri was deeply moved. He sat with the rhythm sticks motionless in his hands, stony-faced, while tears trickled down his cheeks. "Im remind me of my daddy," he said in explanation. Later, I discovered that Yulungur was created and played at funerals, in order, as Magani put it, to say last bye-bye. And the last time Jarabiri had assisted in the painting of a trumpet was at the death of his father. I asked Magani if it was easy to produce a sound from this simple instrument. "You try 'em," he said, adding, when I looked hesitant, "Hear me all right? You try 'em." I lay on the ground, as Magani had done, put the waxed end to my mouth, and pursed my lips as though I were going to play a bugle. I blew and produced a loud hiccuping noise, at least an octave higher than the bass rumble Magani produced. Jarabiri was horrified. "Stop, stop!" he said, putting his fingers to his ears. "Little boy, woman, they hear." I put the trumpet down quickly, but I suspect he flattered my skill, for it was a most difficult instrument to play. To do it properly, your lips had to be loose and floppy, and even Magani required several trial puffs to assess the frequency of the lip vibration necessary before he could make the whole column of air in the trumpet resonate. Later that same day, there was a crisis. Magani and Jarabiri were by no means the only people entitled to play Yulungur. An old bearded man, partially humpbacked, whom I had not seen before, walked into the shelter in the early evening. The three men talked together for some time. Then the newcomer lay down and put the trumpet to his lips. He blew, but he could get no note. Magani watched impatiently. Jarabiri looked agitated. Again the humpbacked man blew and failed. Magani brusquely pushed him to one side and took the trumpet himself, but he could produce no note either. He tried again and again. He sat up with an appalled expression on his face. "I think Debo Debo, go inside," he said to me in awed tones. "Or maybe," he added as an equal possibility, "he got split." Jarabiri and he examined the whole instrument minutely. They could find nothing wrong. I remembered my own effort to play earlier in the afternoon and hoped that no one would connect the two happenings. Magani lay down and tried once more. This time the great whispering boom came from the end. We all smiled with relief. But that night they took no chances. They stuffed a plug of paper bark in each end, and Jarabiri vehemently recited an incantation over it to forbid entry, not only to all Debbledebbles, but also to the spirit of his father and grandfather. Then the trumpet was hidden once more beneath bark and leaves at the back of the shelter. While the painting of Yolngu was proceeding secretly and quietly, many other rituals were being held covertly in odd corners of the bush, for the two tribes, Burada and Gunavigi, were each divided into several clans, which were again subdivided into totemic groups, and each of these communities was responsible for its own rituals. Furthermore, each man owned objects that were sacred, which he cherished and communed with in solitude, and which only his close relations belonging to the same totem were permitted to see. To walk through the bush thus became a matter of discretion and delicacy, if one was not to intrude on some stranger's privacy. Sometimes we recruited a young man to carry our camera gear, and on the first occasion we did so, I spotted, sitting in an acacia tree, a lory, a parrot-like bird with a red head and breast. It flew off, and I followed it excitedly, calling to the boy with the gear to follow me. I pushed through some bushes and crept slowly ahead, my eyes riveted to the bird. I turned round and saw that the boy was standing rooted to the ground. The bird took flight again, and as I went after it, I called once more to the boy in harsher tones. Only then did I notice an old man sitting on a log some 20 yards away. Across his knees he held a long wooden object, bound with twine, which he was anointing with the sweat from his armpits. The boy had stopped some distance behind me, but had come close enough to see the old man. While we stood there, the old man removed the object from his knees, pushed it beneath the log, and covered it with a piece of bark. Then he walked over to us and spoke to the boy. Between them they agreed on a fine that the boy would have to pay, 2 tins of tobacco. Obviously I had to pay the fine. Doubtless they realised that I would do so, and increased the amount accordingly. Nonetheless, there was no question that such infringements of ritual privacy had always to be expiated in some way, and in fully tribal conditions similar crimes would only be settled by much more severe penalties. Yolngu was almost finished. At each end it was ringed with a band of brilliant orange lory feathers. The one nearer the mouthpiece was also decorated with 2 long tassels of string, interwoven with white downy feathers, and weighted with beeswax. Between the goannas and the Yolngu symbols ran little geckos with flattened dotted tails. Here and there crawled columns of small oval creatures that were either multi-legged or else excessively hairy. I asked Magani what they were.
"Cheeky beggars," he said.
Cheeky in pidgin means something that stings or bites. I established that they were not ants, but small creatures that were found on the backs of leaves during the rainy season. Perhaps they represented the caterpillars of moths that often have stinging hairs, but precisely what they were and why they figured on the trumpet I never discovered. Yolngu was now a magnificently resplendent object. Magani carefully bound on the last of the bands, picking out the feathers from a small bag and tying them in one by one. He fastened the string with a final knot. Then he lay down and blew the trumpet once more. He sat up.
"Im finish," he announced solemnly. "Tomorrow time, make him dance."
We now discovered the parts that the two men were to play in the ceremonial. Jarabili belonged to the Goanna clan, and he would enact the part of his totemic ancestor. Magani, on the other hand, had a different, though closely associated, totem, or dreaming, as he termed it. To show us what it was, he took us back to the studio shelter. He brought out his pipe, and, making sure no woman or child was about, carefully unfastened the wrapping. Along the stem were engraved a line of triangles, alternate ones being neatly cross-hatched, the symbols of rain clouds.
"This, my dreaming," he said. "So I blow Yolngu."
The next day was a Saturday. Soon after noon the men began to drift to the shelter. Among them I recognised the man who was in charge of the settlement garden, another who mixed concrete for the constructors. Some were old men whom I had not seen before. Several arrived wearing trousers, but they removed them and put on loincloths. Jarabili and another man cleared a wide space in front of the shelter of bushes and saplings. One man lay down on his back, and another produced ochres and began drawing a goanna on his companion's chest. Soon there were several couples painting one another. They used exactly the same technique as Magani had employed in making his bark paintings. The outline of the design was first roughly smeared with the juicy end of an orchid stem, and the painting in white, red, and yellow was executed with just the same type of twig brushes. While they were being decorated, the men lay with their eyes closed, motionless and impassive, almost as though they were entranced. Though the designs were similar, the placing of them varied. Some had their heads pointing upwards on the chest, others downwards. Jarabili's goanna was even bigger than most. Its tongue reached to his hip, its tail stretched across his shoulder. But they were all drawn in exactly the same style, viewed from the top, legs splayed, cross-hatched on the body, heart and gut represented just as we had seen them on Magani's barks. All the men had a broad white stripe daubed across their foreheads, and another in red below the eyes and across the bridge of the nose. Each man carried a dilly bag. When Magani appeared, he was more spectacularly decorated than anyone, as we might have expected, knowing his impish, flamboyant character. Around his forehead he had bound a long rope of woven lorry feathers, and he had broader, more brilliant red and white face stripes. He did not, however, bear a goanna on his chest, for that was not his totem. It was not until the late afternoon that all had been painted. Those who had been decorated first had been sitting in the shade of the surrounding bush. Now they all assembled in the shelter, lying on their backs. Yulungur, all this time, had remained hidden at the back of the shelter. A group of young men were escorted to the ground. They stood to one side, their eyes averted. It was for them that the ceremony was being held. They were about to witness a holy mystery that hitherto had been an awesome secret. The rasping drone of the trumpet sounded from the shelter. Yulungur was roaring within the well. Magani, crouching on his knees, was blowing the trumpet, while another man held the other end a foot or so above the ground. As Magani played, he crawled slowly forward, so that the trumpet passed over the prostrate goanna men. Led by a man chanting and striking the rhythm sticks, the snake emerged from the shelter, the sacred well. Still roaring, it summoned two of the goannas, who wriggled out, their bellies close to the dust, gripping their dilly bags in their teeth. As they reached the open space of the dancing ground, they rolled over onto their backs. The snake moved back over them and returned to bring another pair out of the shelter. Still the snake sang with a regular rhythmic diapason. The voice of the singer intoned Yulungur's name, repeating again and again the same wailing cadence, while the metallic clicking notes of the rhythm sticks echoed among the trees. The snake escorted the goannas in pairs out of the well until all were lying on their backs in a line in the open, the emblems on their chests glowing in the yellow light of the sinking sun. With controlled, tense movements, the goannas rolled over onto their knees, still gripping their dilly bags in their mouths. Slowly they reared up, their arms bent, their fingers crooked like talons. Again and again this happened, as the line advanced across the open space in front of the symbolic well. The rhythm sticks, which had been sounding a regular, rapid beat, suddenly changed to half the speed, and the voice of the singer became more urgent and exciting. The goannas were electrified into action, and grunting loudly they reared upright, fingers crooked, dilly bags in their mouths, trembling all over. They remained rigidly in this position for some seconds. Then the snake ceased to roar, the dancers relaxed, and everyone strolled away, back to the encampment.
Thank you.
We flew back from Maningrida to Darwin. Our work in the north was almost ended. Next, we planned to go south to Alice Springs and see something of the very different desert country of Central Australia. Before we left Darwin, we had to buy more stores, get our car overhauled, and say goodbye to friends. It was so hot in Darwin that a walk down the length of the main street was enough to make our shirts cling to our backs with perspiration. We wanted a drink. Darwinians are apt to boast that they drink more beer per head of the population than any other citizens in the world. So, as might be expected of a town with such a formidable record, there is no difficulty in finding a bar. You can drink beer in the formal lounge of one of the smarter hotels, sitting in an easy chair among plastic flowers and waiters with black ties and cummerbunds, but really serious thirst-quenching is more properly carried out in bars. Here the atmosphere is much more business-like. The one we chose was tiled and chromium-plated throughout, and devoid of any frills or decorations that did not directly further the primary purpose of the place. The whole of one wall was occupied by one vast refrigerator with glass doors. From it, a brassy and energetic barmaid was dispensing chilled beer with extreme speed. The glasses in which she served it were also frozen to ensure that the beer was not a degree warmer than absolutely necessary by the time it reached the eager lips of her customers. Freezing glasses to the fastidious Australian beer drinker is as essential a ritual as warming the teapot in England. In the bar, we met Doug Lockwood. Doug is an author and journalist. It's difficult to imagine that there's anyone who has a wider knowledge of the territory than he, and impossible to believe that anyone could be more generous with information or more hospitable. We talked to some of the characters in the territory, and the conversation turned to no-hopers. A no-hoper is a man who has forsworn the comforts of civilization, shunned society, and gone to live in solitude, and the empty immensities of northern Australia enable aspiring no-hopers to achieve their aims with greater ease and success than anywhere else in the world. But such men are not by any means restricted to the Northern Territory. Charles and I had met one 5 years earlier in Queensland. We were on our way to New Guinea and had left Cairns to sail up the Great Barrier Reef. About 100 miles north of the town, the engine of our launch stopped with a crash that shook the entire craft. A connecting rod had broken, shattering the piston head and bending the main shaft. By clearing out the debris, we were able to get the engine turning again, but the best speed we could make was a mere 2 knots. While we were still wiping the oil from our hands, the radio warned us of an approaching hurricane. If we were caught in a storm while we were still crippled, we should be in serious trouble. Making the best speed we could, we limped towards the coast to seek safety. The most suitable haven seemed to be a dot on the map marked Portland Roads. It was as remote and isolated as any place on that desolate coast, but during the war the Americans had built a jetty there in order to bring supplies to a military airfield there constructed in the scrub a few miles inland. As far as we knew, it was now abandoned, but the jetty at least would give us a degree of shelter if a hurricane did come our way. With agonizing slowness we wallowed westwards. At last a smear of hills appeared above the horizon. As we came nearer, we saw, to our surprise, a tiny figure seated on the end of the jetty. He was fishing, with his back towards us. As we came alongside, I stood in the bows and yelled out to him to catch our line. He didn't move. I hailed him again and again, but still he showed no sign of hearing me. Eventually, our bows scraped against the piles of the jetty. I jumped out and clambered my way up the timbers. It was a painful process, for they were encrusted with barnacles and oysters. Charles threw me a line, and we made fast. Together we went over to the man who had remained stolidly fishing throughout. I found it hard to believe that anyone in as lonely a spot as this would not be anxious to see a new face or talk to another human being. He was a little shrivelled man, naked but for a pair of torn shorts and a frayed straw hat. "G'day," I said. "G'day," he replied.
The conversation lapsed. For some reason, I felt it incumbent upon me to keep it going. I explained who we were, where we had come from, and why we had arrived there. The old man listened impassively, blinking up at me through a pair of steel-rimmed spectacles. When I finally came to an end, he pulled in his line, stiffly got to his feet, looked at me meditatively, and said, "The name's Mac." With that, he turned and slowly walked away down the long jetty, his bare, calloused feet slapping on the hot sunbeach planks. We were stranded at Portland Roads for several days. Mac, as we discovered, had actually got a job. He received a small salary from some official authority to be permanently on hand on the jetty in order to catch the lines of any craft that might put in. We must have been his only customers for at least 2 months. The Americans' airstrip inland had been kept clear of bush in order to serve as an emergency landing ground, and Mac had also the additional responsibility of taking up heavy drums of aviation spirit landed at the jetty every 6 months or so to a dump on the airstrip. To do so, he used a lorry. This was an astonishing machine. Mac had run it for years on top-grade aviation spirit. The engine, he said, was well-nigh perfect. In fact, its only fault was the radiator, which had a tendency to leak. He explained with an aggrieved air that he had applied all reasonable remedies. He had plastered it back and front with cement and poured repeated billyfuls of porridge into it, but still it continued to drip. This, he reckoned, was willful obstinacy. On the other hand, he did admit that the chassis was now getting, well, a little old. The mudguards had been replaced with flattened kerosene cans. The timbers at the back, what few of them remained, were secured with pieces of string. Even more serious, the main frame of the vehicle was cracked, and the front half seemed only very tenuously connected to the rear. Riding in the cabin was, therefore, a somewhat unnerving experience, for when the front wheels hit a bump, your knees were pushed into your chest, and when they went into a dip, the floorboard seemed suddenly to drop away from beneath your feet. Having sent a radio message to Cairns asking for a launch to be sent up with spare parts, we had nothing to do except wait, and we occupied ourselves by chipping oysters from the piles of the jetty. Raw or fried, they were the most delicious I had ever tasted. Mac lived on the hill above the shore in a shelter of rusting corrugated iron that was almost submerged by a huge tip of empty beer cans and broken bottles. When he wasn't sitting on the jetty with a fishing line in his hand, Mac spent most of his time outside the shack, just sitting. One evening I went up and joined him. In a burst of unusual loquacity, he told me what had first brought him here. He had come to search for gold. Many other men had been prospecting in the same area, both before and since. A few of them had made good strikes, but not Mac. "Well, found a few colours," he said, in a matter-of-fact tone. "Never enough to make it payable." He rolled himself a cigarette one-handed. "Didn't bother going on looking after a couple of years. Still, there's plenty up there if you're interested," he added. "But as far as I'm concerned, it can stay. I'm right." "How long have you been here now?" I asked. 35 year," he replied. "Well, Mac," I said, I reckon I know why you stayed. Those oysters on the jetty are the finest in the world, I reckon." Mac lit his cigarette. The paper flamed, and he puffed hard until the tobacco was properly alight. "Oh, that's good," he said. "I'm partial to a nice oyster. Often wondered what they'd be like." He leaned against the wall of his hut. "I've been meaning to get round to picking off a few. Just never seem to have the time." Doug Lockwood laughed at the story and ordered another round of beer. "Yeah," he said, "Mac would be a dinkum no-hoper. But you can find a lot of blokes round the territory are just the same. If you wanted to see three together, then the place to go is Borroloola. It's a ghost town. Just a few crumbling shacks, and among the ruins, these three blokes." "Sounds interesting," I said. "Where is it?" Well, you just drive straight down the bitumen, and when you get to Daly Waters, turn left. From then on, it's a straight run. So, the next morning before dawn, we drove through the dark, cool streets of Darwin and headed south. That day was uneventful. The road stretched monotonously ahead, a strip of bitumen 20 yards wide and 1,000 miles long. There was little traffic, and even settlements were as much as 50 miles apart. Well before nightfall, we arrived at Daly Waters. The next day we started on the second lap, and turned left at the signpost, which said simply, Borroloola, 240 miles. We bowled along the even road at a steady 50 miles an hour. The track was so straight that for 20 or 30 miles on end there was no need to move the steering wheel more than a few inches. Desiccated, dusty bushes intermingled with low termite hills grew thinly along the arid, gravelly ground. The unwavering straightness of the road, the uniformity of the vegetation, were tedious, and when we were not driving, we dozed. And when we opened our eyes again, the view was so similar that we might never have moved. 100 miles, 110 miles, 120 miles, we rattled on. Every hour and a half we stopped, changed drivers, allowed the engine to cool, topped up with water, oil and petrol. Our progress, if dull, was at least satisfactory. And then we hit the dust. In the territory, it's always called bull dust. No one's quite sure why, but most people were able to suggest a coarse origin. Whatever its derivation, the word has now become enshrined in official literature, and to call it simply dust would be grossly inadequate. I don't believe that there's any other dust in the world quite like it. It's so odd that scientists have awarded it a special geological identity. In Alice Springs, we were told, people bottle it and sell it for good money to tourists who take it back south to substantiate their stories of the rigours of travel in the territory. In consistency, it's so fine that it has the sticky quality of talc. It lay across the road in great drifts that completely concealed potholes and boulders big enough to break an axle if a car hit them at speed. Sometimes we plunged into a patch so deep that it broke right over the car, like a wave of water over a launched lifeboat. Sometimes it took on an eerie personality of its own, like an ectoplasmic monster in a horror film, for when we slackened speed, the clouds in our wake overtook us, creeping alongside our window in a threatening dirty white wall. We would accelerate quickly, with the sensation that we were being pursued. We kept a close watch on the milometer. Our speed had now dropped to barely half. With maddening slowness, it clicked up past 220, past 230. When it reached 240, we were still driving across a flat expanse of empty plain. According to the signpost at Daly Waters, we should have arrived at Borroloola. Yet here there was no sign of human habitation. Maybe, bemused by the straightness of the road, we'd not noticed a turning off to Borroloola, and we were now driving down a track which continued for another 300 empty miles into Queensland. And then, when the milometer read 248, we saw a signpost lying in the grass by the side of the road. Its finger, pointing vertically to the sky, proclaimed, Borroloola store, 3 miles, petrol and oil. Once we judged, it must have directed the traveller down a vague turning on the opposite side. Heartened, we drove down it, and within 10 minutes we saw ahead a derelict building of corrugated iron beneath a mango tree. Beyond, a line of verdant trees marked the course of a river, the MacArthur. We had arrived. We camped that night on the bank of the MacArthur. It was a perfect sight. We pitched our tents on a wide sandy flat in the shade of a grove of casuarina trees. On the other side of the wide rippling river stood the remains of a few Aboriginal shelters. As the sun went down, we built a large log fire. I spread out my sleeping bag beside it and read by the light of its leaping flames. From the dark river came the flatulent honks of crocodiles,
and the slap of leaping fish. Now it was deliciously cool, and I was grateful for the cover of my sleeping bag. The stars shone through the feathery leaves of the casuarinas with a crystalline brilliance. After the breath-robbing heat, the dust, and the din of the drive, the place seemed paradisial. It was easy to understand why men had chosen this place to found a town. The next morning we looked round the remains of the settlement. Only three buildings still stood, each widely separated from the others. The old police station was now the residence of a government officer whose responsibility it was to look after the welfare of the Aborigines, who camped in a bush on the other side of the river. A mile beyond it, across a ravine which in the wet season is the bed of a torrent running into the MacArthur, stood the small store to which the fallen signpost had directed us. There you could buy petrol and oil, beer, tinned fruit, bully beef, papier-mâché cowboy hats, and boiled sweets. Its customers were Aborigines, the occasional traveller on his way from or to Queensland, or horsemen from the cattle stations who, when out on a wide-ranging muster of their stock, might find themselves within a few hours' ride of Borroloola and reckoned it would be worthwhile calling in to have a beer and talk to another human being. The third building, and the biggest of the three, was the derelict hotel near our camp by the river. Its half-stripped corrugated iron roof clanged and creaked ominously in the slightest wind. Its verandas were buckled and sagging. All around it, like flotsam accumulated round a breakwater, lay drifts of rubbish. Broken rum bottles, jagged rusting beer cans, oil drums, half the chassis of a car, its steering wheel entwined with withered creepers, and strange wheels and levers of cast iron that must have formed part of some machine whose function I couldn't even guess at. Inside, the floorboards crumbled beneath our feet. They were no more than paper-thin shells, most of the wood having been eaten from the inside by termites. A mildewed mirror hung askew on the wooden wall, an iron bedstead rusted crookedly in a corner. Among a pile of rubbish I found a book. Its title, The Imitation of Christ by Thomas a Kempis. Who could have brought such an erudite mystical work all the way out here? I turned over its title page. Inside, the termites had eaten nearly all the holy man's words. Close by, curling and so brittle that pieces broke off in my hand, I found a map. It was dated 1888 and boldly titled The Town of Borroloola. Towards the end of the last century, cattlemen, having established stations the size of English counties in Queensland, were moving west around the southern shores of the Gulf and into the still unexplored emptiness of the Northern Territory. Although the MacArthur River is tidal and brackish, its waters are sweet enough to be drinkable, and here the stockmen watered the herds a thousand or more strong, with which they hoped they would be able to populate their unseen cattle runs. Here, too, they could collect stores, for the river was easily navigable up to this point, and although the voyage from Darwin was 1,000 miles long and might take 6 months to complete, it was cheaper and quicker to bring them in here than to haul them overland from Alice Springs. So the banks of the MacArthur became a regular camping place where men and beasts could rest and recoup before launching off once more into the dusty aridity of the territory. When gold was discovered away west in the Kimberleys, prospectors started overlanding from all parts of Australia in their haste to make a fortune. Many followed the cattle trails from Queensland and into the territory by way of Borroloola. Those were tough times. Fights between Aborigines and the white men who marched across their tribal grounds were continually breaking out. A solitary prospector was in constant danger. To add to his difficulties, the country in the dry season was so arid that a man could easily die of thirst. Many did. The wiser ones proceeded cautiously from one known waterhole to another. One famous character in Borroloola was more successful than most, for he had married an Aboriginal woman. With her as his guide, he was able to travel in areas where no European could go on his own. For she, a nomad who had spent her life wandering through this country, knew exactly which fold in the rocks held water the longest, just where to dig with your hands to make a hole into which underground water would seep as a brown, scummy fluid. Together, the two of them explored the territory inland from Borroloola. Each night they built a fire, and when his wife lay down to sleep by the side of it, the old bushman rolled his blankets into the shape of a body and put it down as a dummy on the other side of the fire. Then he climbed a tree and spent the night sleeping in the crotch with his rifle in his lap. Only too often in the morning, a gash in his blankets showed where it had been silently speared during the night. By then, Borroloola had grown to the size of a small frontier settlement and seemed destined to blossom into a full-blown town. The map that we had found in the hotel showed the positions of hypothetical thoroughfares and squares, each labelled with a splendid-sounding name: Leichhardt Street, Burt Street, MacArthur Terrace. The main road, Riddock Terrace, extended into a blank on the chart and ended with an arrow labelled to Palmerston. Maybe this was a somewhat macabre joke on the part of the surveyors, or perhaps a device to encourage property speculators in the south to buy plots, for Palmerston was the contemporary name for Darwin, which was separated from the infant township by 540 miles of trackless desert. Nonetheless, Borroloola had the makings of a town. A police corporal, with his own jail, was stationed there to try and bring some semblance of law to the wild horde of cattlemen and desperate prospectors who congregated on the banks of the MacArthur. He was a man with literary tastes, and he sent a request down to Melbourne for a library. Astonishingly, 1,000 books were dispatched almost immediately. They were 6 months on the road before they reached their destination. Further consignments increased it to 3,000 volumes. Horse teams and wagons, waited by the government wharf on the river, ready to take the cargoes of stores discharged by the supply ships, and haul them out into the territory and up into the fertile Barclay Tablelands, where cattle stations were now established. About 1913, the first car left the main north-south highway in the centre of the territory and drove out to Borroloola. Its tyres were protected by wrappings of buffalo hide, and it followed a track which in the past had taken the best part of a year to cover in a horse-drawn buggy. Gold, coal, copper, and silver lead were discovered in the surrounding hills. In addition to the police station, there were by then 2 hotels, 5 stores, and a permanent population of 50 white folk. Borroloola seemed at last to be about to fulfil the hopes of the surveyors, who so many years before had pegged out the lines of streets in the desert. But in Australia, towns seem to be much more frail than they are elsewhere. In crowded Europe, a settlement seldom dies. Once it's established, it usually acquires a momentum of its own, even after the initial stimulus for its foundation has lost its validity, and it continues to create new activities and careers for its inhabitants. But human settlement in the territory has flickered only fitfully over the vast empty spaces. It dies out here and springs up elsewhere. Only in a few places does it burn continuously. And when it gutters and dies, people just move out, leaving the empty buildings behind them. There is no overspill of unhoused people anxious to take them over. No one bothers to knock down the rotting shacks for the sake of tidiness or for the benefit of a land-hungry population. No one even sees the deserted site. The homes are left to moulder, lost and forgotten. As time went by, more and more artesian wells were bored inland, and Borroloola lost its importance as a watering place. The Kimberley gold rush petered out. The big migrations of cattle and men from Queensland came to an end. New roads in the territory made it easier for the stores to reach the cattle stations overland. One by one, the wagons rotted where they stood, until nothing was left of them but the iron tires of their wheels. Termites ate the entire library, except for the one surviving volume we had found in the hotel. Few cars followed the pioneering motorist of 1913, and several of those that did roared and coughed their way to Borroloola and got no further. For although the mechanical ingenuity of the Australian bushman is great, there are some breakages inflicted by the ferocious terrain that can only be put right by replacement, and there were no spare parts in Borroloola. Up in the hot hills, the last of the full-time prospectors, sitting alone on his claim, shot himself. Slowly, Borroloola dwindled and died. But to some, the three men we had come to seek, the husk of the dead town was more attractive than it would ever have been if it had grown and flourished. To them, this was the best place on earth. Jack Mulholland had been the last keeper of Borroloola's hotel. We found him sitting on the threshold of a small dilapidated outbuilding that had once served as the post office. It was a position that he occupied with the permanence of a statue on its pedestal. Whenever we visited him, Mull was there in exactly the same attitude. If we drove by at dusk, we could see his dim outline framed against the permanently open door. If we arrived soon after dawn, Mull would be seated at his post. I was almost tempted to creep up in the middle of the night with a torch to see if he slept in this position as well. So accustomed did we become to see him sitting there, that when one afternoon towards the end of our stay I arrived and found the doorway empty, I feared that something calamitous had happened. Alarmed, I looked inside the door. There lay Mull, outstretched on the floor in the midst of a litter of blankets, old car batteries, and tattered magazines. Apprehensively, I took a step inside. His chest heaved, and to my relief, he emitted a reverberating snore. Mull was a short, stocky Irishman in his late 50s. Although he had spent much of his life in Australia, his voice still retained a twang of brogue. He spoke softly and slowly. His eyes were permanently narrowed against the ferocity of the sun. His hair was still ungrayed and thick. He first came up this way, he told us, because he had heard that the loo was a good place. He hadn't seen this part of the country, so he decided to look it over. He found it to be all that its reputation had promised.
"So I just stayed," he said, "and put in 4 or 5 months reading at the library. And then the owners of the hotel wanted someone to run it for them, so I took it over and I've been here ever since."
He looked contemplatively at the huge crumbling building.
"It wasn't a very demanding job," he added modestly. "It suited me."
How many guests might you have at any one time?"
"Oh, never more than one at a time," said Mull, shocked at the thought. "Come to think of it, I can't remember more than 3 guests in all the time I've been here."
"Oh, no wonder it closed," I said.
"Yes," said Mull, rubbing his unshaven chin reflectively and squinting up at the withered fronds of a palm tree that the wind was brushing against the roof. "Yes, it wasn't really a tremendously vigorous financial concern."
We were sitting on the steps of his shack. Around us stretched a sea of tin cans and broken rum bottles. "Been doing a bit of drinking?" I asked.
"Oh, no," said Mull stoically. "Don't get a chance, really. Most of those bottles would be 20 years old.
Ever thought of tidying the place up?" Mull looked at me severely.
"Tidiness," he said, "is a disease of the mind."
Although Mull had very few material needs, he still had to buy flour, tobacco, and ammunition from the store. I asked him how he managed for money.
"Oh, shooting crocodiles for their hides, hunting for dingo, but they're pretty scarce round here these days. Of course, I do a bit of radio repair work."
This last seemed as unlikely an occupation as could have been devised for someone living in such a remote and unpopulated spot as this. We discovered, however, that Mull had a considerable reputation throughout this part of the country for being able to coax antiquated radios to life. He effected most of his repairs by a process of continuous cannibalism. A cattleman riding through Borroloola would dump a busted radio on Mull and ask him if he could fix it. In his own good time, Mull would identify the fault. Solder joints and connections in this climate only too often came adrift, and sometimes the repair was easy enough. But more often a valve was burnt out, or a part needed complete replacement. Mull would then wait for maybe 6 months or so until another set came in for repair. Then he would remove the part from the second that he needed for the first. The cumulative demands made on each set meant that eventually some unfortunate man would be told that his radio, lying in the back of Mull's shanty, stripped of its valves and condensers, was totally irreparable, and then the process would start all over again. "I write 'em," said Mull, "or wreck 'em." Mull, indeed, was a bush mechanic of a stature amounting to near genius. Beside his shack stood a 1928 Pontiac car, according at least to the label on its bonnet. Very few of the original parts still remained, and the machine was more an anthology of extracts from vehicles that had arrived and stayed to rot in Borroloola over the last 50 years. Its mammoth wooden-spoked rear wheels were of a quite different vintage from those on the front. All its tyres were flat, and a large termite hill lay in the middle of the engine on top of a rectangular cylinder block of primitive simplicity and elegance. Superficially, there was little to distinguish the machine from the other wrecks that lay nearby on the grass, and it was difficult to imagine that it had been going within the last 10 years. I nearly offended Mull deeply by putting this thought into words and asking him when he last used it. Fortunately, I checked myself in time and rephrased my question. "How often do you take her out?" I asked. "I can start at any time you like," he replied defensively, "and she'll go places your land bloody rover won't." To prove his point, he offered to take her out for a spin the next day. The preparations necessary for this were considerable, but Mull had been so hurt by my imputation that he was stung into activity. First, a water pump had to be fitted. He discovered one in an old hulk that lay in the courtyard, and spent the afternoon filing grooves and notches in it so that it fitted his machine. The next morning, all was ready. The Pontiac had been constructed long before the advent of electric starters, and the handle that was originally provided had long since been lost. But Mull had his own magnificently logical methods. First, he jacked up the rear wheels until they were well clear of the ground. Then he put the engine into gear and started turning the back wheels by seizing hold of the spokes and heaving them round. It was an arduous job, and Mull poured sweat. After 5 minutes there was a tremendous roar, and the engine shook into life. Mull dashed to the front, put the shuddering engine into neutral, and jacked down the back axle. With dignity he walked to the front, clambered into the seat, and then proudly drove out to do a lap of honour round the hotel. On one occasion, we learned later, Mull had taken an extended trip into the bush, the stimulus being provided by the arrival of a police officer in Borroloola. It wasn't that he had anything to hide or to be afraid of, but he saw no sense in becoming entangled with the law unnecessarily. For 3 weeks, no one saw him. Then, one day, the distant, unmistakable roar of the car heralded his approach across the flat plain. When he was within half a mile of home, the engine stopped. Mull could either have repaired it there and then, or have covered the remaining distance on foot, so that after so long an absence he could sleep once more under his own roof. But he did neither. He clambered out, lit a fire, put on a billy for tea, spread out his swag, and went to sleep in the shade beneath the car. He stayed there for 3 days, pondering on what might have gone amiss with the engine. Finally, he looked inside the bonnet and cleaned the plugs. The engine started immediately, and unruffled, he completed his journey home. I asked Mull what he did on these trips out in the bush.
"Oh, prospectin', mostly," he said.
"Have you ever found anything?"
"Well, got a bit of gold, opal, silver lead. Never payable."
"Isn't that a bit disappointing?"
"Not at all," he replied with unaccustomed vehemence. "It 'ud break a man's heart if he did discover anything. What else would there be to live for? Money's no good to you anyway."
"Well, it can make life comfortable and easy," I suggested.
"What you gonna do with it, then?" said Mull. "Buy yourself a few luxury yachts, drink it, spend it on beautiful women? I can see no sense in that."
"No, no. If I've learnt one thing in me life, it is that the measure of a man's riches are the fewness of his wants. I'm happy enough."
"Well," I said, "there can't be that many people who could live with as few comforts as you have and still say they're happy."
"Ah," said Mull compassionately, "then they've a screw loose somewhere. Definitely a screw loose."
Mull's nearest neighbour was Borroloola's oldest inhabitant, Roger Jose. He had arrived here in 1916, and had only left it for short periods of time on three or four occasions. He was a noble-looking man, with a long grey beard of patriarchal proportions, curling silver hair, and deeply scorched, wrinkled skin. The clothes he wore were bizarre. A strange peaked cap in the shape of a legionnaire's kepi, but made to his own design from pandanus fibres. The arms of his shirt had been deliberately cut off from the shoulder, and he had trimmed his trousers just below the knee. If he had walked onto the stage in a production of Treasure Island as Ben Gunn, the audience might well have thought that the costume designer and makeup men had indulged their imagination a little too freely. No one knew how old he was, and Roger himself was not a reliable guide, for he had been saying that he was 69 for at least the last 6 years. His house was as odd as his dress, a circular construction of corrugated iron, windowless and with a single small door in the side. Originally, it had been a 5,000-gallon water tank, holding the hotel's supply of rainwater. Roger had dismantled it and re-erected it a mile away, partly to escape the danger of falling sheets of corrugated iron flung from the roof of the disintegrating hotel by high winds that sometimes sweep the plain, and partly because, with Mull in residence, Roger reckoned the hotel was becoming a little overcrowded. Roger was the last custodian of the library. Before the books were entirely consumed by the termites, he had read nearly all of them, and in doing so had acquired a passion not only for learning, but for words. Words, indeed, obsessed him. He savoured them like succulent sweets. He rolled them off his tongue with relish. He pondered their precise meanings and derivations. When I asked what food he ate, he replied, "Well, I would fain crave my master's oxen, but I can't get them. Thus I am compelled to pursue the elusive marsupial." Occasionally, Taz Festing, the welfare officer living in the old police station, visited Roger, who would welcome the opportunity to share some of the more delectable words that he had dredged up from his memory since Taz's last visit. The conversation would usually start with Roger remarking absently, "I was reading something the other day." As far as Roger was concerned, the other day might well have meant 10 or 15 years ago, for his eyesight had prevented him from reading anything for a long time past. Then he would innocently put a question, hoping that Taz might either be stumped for an answer or give a wrong one, so that he could triumphantly correct him. One day, Taz took the initiative. "Roger," he said, "have you ever, in the course of your reading, come across a leotard?" Roger squinted suspiciously at Taz.
I think I saw the skin of one once," he said tentatively. "Couldn't have," said Taz. "Leotards don't have skins."
Silence.
"Okay, what is a leotard?" challenged Roger.
But Taz wouldn't tell him. 3 days later, Roger made the journey over to Taz's house. The unsuspected gap in his knowledge had worried him so much that he'd been unable to sleep. He had to know the answer. Only then did Taz tell him that a leotard was a ballet dancer's practice costume.
"Oh, I felt a real quarter-wit," said Roger when he told us about it. "I should have known that one."
But Roger had gleaned more than mere words from all his reading. He had a taste for poetry and was fond of quoting Gray, Shakespeare, Omar Khayyam, and the Bible. He recognised, too, that he was an abnormal character.
"But I'm not subnormal," he added quickly. "Don't run away with that idea. I used to live in towns once with other people and got on perfectly all right. But that was before I got this superiority complex, before I decided I could find no company better than my own. I came out of the wilderness looking for peace. This here is as far as I can go. In a sense, I suppose, I'm at bay."
"Don't you ever find the loneliness overpowering?" I asked.
"How can I be lonely?" he replied softly. "With God."
His voice quavered and he stopped. Then he brightened.
"And with old Omar and the immortal Bill."
2 miles beyond Roger's tank, across the dry creek bed, and beyond the store, lived the most determined recluse of Borroloola, Jack the Mad Fiddler. He sat alone in his cabin week after week, playing his violin. We were warned that it was not advisable to visit him without an invitation to do so. Jack, on occasion, had been known to greet unexpected arrivals with a shotgun, and angrily warn them off his property. One morning, however, when we drove up to the hotel to pay a call on Mull, we saw an unfamiliar lorry standing by the old post office. On the running board sat a small, bird-like man with spectacles and matchstick-thin legs. Mull introduced us to him. Jack looked at us suspiciously, said a grudging g'day, got to his feet, and opened the door of his truck. For a moment I thought he was going to leave immediately. However, he merely reached inside and brought out a small screw-top jar full of water. He unscrewed the lid, took a few sips, carefully replaced the top, and set it down on the bonnet of the truck. Mull and he were in deep conversation about the nature of free will. This may sound as though these men, in their loneliness, were exclusively concerned with questions of philosophy. I don't think that this was so. It was simply that in these circumstances it's almost impossible to make small talk. There's no raw material to base it on. Jack spoke quickly and nervously, with a hint of Edwardian upper-class accent beneath his Australian phraseology. He spoke of girls and motoring. I remember hearing that he was a titled son of an English aristocratic family. "These fellows," Mull said to Jack, pointing to us,
"have been asking me why I came out here. Why do you reckon you came, Jack?"
Jack looked at us aggressively.
"I was sent out of England for England's good," he said flatly.
There was an embarrassed pause.
They tell me you play the violin," I said, anxious to change the subject. "Yes, I've been at it for 7 years now."
"Well, what sort of things do you play?"
"Scales, mostly," he replied.
"Oh, well, what about tunes?"
"Well, wait on," said Jack mildly. "The violin's a very tricky instrument, you know. Fritz Kreisler and fellas like that had a fair start on me because they were learning when they were knee-high to a grasshopper. I've taken it up rather late in life."
He took a sip from his jar of water.
"Still," he said, "I'm thinking of having a crack at Handel's Largo next year, but I'm in no hurry."
It was Jack's ambition to play 18th-century music. There was nothing much before or since that was worth anything in his estimation.
"And anyway," he added, "this modern stuff costs quids for a few sheets. You can get Bach and Beethoven by the bale for a few bob." "Well," he said, "I can't waste my time jabbering to you blokes. I'd better be going." And he climbed into his car.
"I was wondering whether we could come and visit you some time, Jack."
"I don't think you're better," he said. "You can never tell what mood I'm in."
He swung the starting handle. The engine rattled asthmatically and he clambered inside. He engaged the gears with a screech, and then he leaned out of the window.
"If you don't bring any of them cameras and recording machines, I suppose it might be all right. See you."
He let out the clutch and drove away. We took up his invitation the next day. We found his cabin on the edge of a beautiful crescent-shaped billabong, haunted by pelicans, egrets, ducks and cockatoos. When we drove up, Jack was busy inside his cabin, and for some time he didn't speak or acknowledge our shouted g'days, but stayed hidden inside. It was as though he was screwing himself up for an ordeal. When he finally emerged, he was attentive and polite, offering us boxes to sit on. No sooner had we seated ourselves, however, than he disappeared again inside the house. Through the open glassless windows, I saw him standing motionless, holding his violin in his hands, staring at it. After fully 2 minutes, he replaced it tenderly in its case and slowly closed the lid. When he came out again, I asked him if we might inspect his instrument.
"I'd rather not," he said quietly.
We had done as we were bidden, and not brought either cameras or recording machines with us. After we had talked together for some time, I raised the subject of his violin again.
"Why," I said jocularly, "the world should know that they've got a budding violinist in the Northern Territory. Who knows, you may be a star in the making."
Jack leaned forward and answered with passion.
"I've had all I want of fame. I was appearing in theatres in the north of England 40 years ago, with actors who are now famous all over the world. I want nothing of that sort of thing."
For a moment I feared I had offended him. He got to his feet, picked up an enamel mug that lay drying on an improvised table of stringy bark. He started to polish it vigorously with a cloth.
"People call us hatters, you know," he said bitterly. "Well, they're right. You think old Mull and Roger are happy, don't you? That's what they've been telling you, isn't it?"
"Well, they're not telling the truth. They're hatters, just the same as I am. They're miserable blokes most of the time, just like me. But a man comes out here for a bit, for one reason or another. He stays on, and before he knows what's happened, he's got to a stage where he can't change his way of life, even if he wanted to." He hung the mug on a nail alongside an enamel plate, which, with a hole punched in its rim, was hanging from another nail.
"Tom, you fellas was going," he said. And he disappeared once more inside his cabin.
We left Borroloola soon afterwards. From Daly Waters the bitumen ran south as straight as a ruled line across a blank immensity of sand, stone and withered scrub. Only occasionally did a rocky outcrop or a stretch of drifting sand deflect it. The few cars that travelled along it moved at speed. There was nothing in the surrounding wilderness to tempt their drivers to linger. Their only anxiety was to cover, as quickly as possible, the brutal 1,000-mile hiatus in civilization that separated Alice Springs from Darwin. Once or twice we passed a land train, a line of gigantic trailers, each the size of a large furniture van, stretching for 50 yards and drawn by an immense diesel lorry the size of a military tank transporter, with 22 gears and the speed of a saloon car. Once it was moving fast, its driver, high up in the vast cab, couldn't possibly stop it within a quarter of a mile, or even manage a swerve. All the other traffic made it their business to get out of its path. These mammoth vehicles were the links between the railhead at Alice Springs and the strange, stunted little railway that straggled down from Darwin for 146 miles before giving up in the bush over 800 miles short of the Alice. Our journey was at an end, our return to London overdue. By the time we'd driven back to Alice Springs, our car could go no further. Racked and pounded by the desert, it couldn't tackle another 1,000 miles back to Darwin without a major overhaul and large-scale repairs. We left it in a garage to be sent back to Darwin on a land train. We ourselves had to fly back. Below us lay the Northern Territory, the Stuart Highway a thin line scratched on its surface. Men had given their lives trying to explore this country. Planters and pastoralists had tried to dominate it and had failed. Prospectors had died trying to rifle it of its minerals. Jack Mulholland and the other men at Borroloola had come to hide themselves in its loneliness. But only the Aborigines, living in their traditional manner, can survive in it unaided. Unlike the white man, they make no attempt to dominate it. They don't try to take its animals or to cultivate its sands, but to them it yields enough to keep a man's soul in his body. In return, the Aborigines worship it. Its rocks and its waterholes are the creations of their gods, and their walkabouts through it become pilgrimages. Perhaps no one else can ever understand it as they do, accepting equally its beauty and its brutality. Soon, even the Stuart Highway was invisible. There was nothing now but empty, arid desert, freckled with bush, stretching monotonously to the horizon.
Quest Under Capricorn was written and read by David Attenborough and produced by Lynn Took for BBC Worldwide.